I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Policy, and Finance, Wednesday, March 30, 2005. Clerk, take the roll.
Chairman Smith.
Here.
Representative Eastland.
Aye.
Cornish.
Here.
Ellison.
Here.
Hillstrom. Johnson.
Here.
Nestle.
Here.
Murphy.
Here.
Nelson.
Here.
Newman.
Here.
Kamar.
Here.
Soddersham.
Here.
Chair notes that we do have the presence of a quorum, therefore we'll take up, first of all, the consideration of the minutes from the March 23rd meeting. They are in the packet. Is there a motion on that? Representative Johnson moves approval. Any discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Those minutes are approved. Committee, we have a number of bills we're going to try to, we are going to do today. We'll see what we can get done this morning. And I'll announce again at the end of the meeting that I believe we're meeting in room 200 later in the day. It'll either be 5 o'clock or a call of the chair. We'll see how many bills are left. So having said that, let's move right into our agenda. House File 928, Representative Soderstrom. Okay. The chair is going to, Representative Soderstrom, the chair is going to move this bill that it be moved without recommendation to the Committee on Government Operations. The bill is before us. We're going to proceed into testimony, and I would like to conclude. We have 8 identified testifiers. We may have some in the audience who have not identified themselves. So I'd like to keep the first 7, which I'm told are proponents, to no more than 30 minutes. So let's try to keep that in mind. And I'd like you to, you have the floor, describe your bill for us.
Excuse me, Mr.
Representative Murphy.
Before you start, Mr. Chair, what about questions along the way?
Well, I think this is all the bills we have are important. This certainly is one of them. I think I'm going to be tolerant, and if there are questions along the way, raise them. And we'll just add on to this evening's time frame if we have to. So let's deal with the questions as they come up, since this bill is...
But at the end of each testimony, testifier's testimony, rather than interrupt their testimony.
Yeah, please. Thanks for the clarification. Wait until the testimony is done, but let's raise our questions after each one. Representative Soderstrom, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I do have an amendment, and I would need to, I'd like to move H-0928-A1 amendment to put this bill in the shape that it needs to be. And this amendment takes all of the reference to the sex offenders out of this bill. And also, it also makes it possible for the parole board to send someone to the challenge incarceration program and gives the parole board option to send an officer or an offender, excuse me, to a secure drug treatment facility. And then it makes some changes that were suggested to me for the Board of Corrections or the parole board itself. So those changes were made, and so I'd like to have this accepted.
Representative Soderstrom, let's get the bill in the shape that you would like it. We'll take up your motion then on H-0928-A1. On that motion, those in favor signify by saying aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Then 928 as amended. Representative Murphy.
I had my hand up for discussion.
I apologize. We can bring it back. We can bring it back. Go ahead.
I would move to reconsider, Mr. Chair.
All right, let's take up that motion. Motion to reconsider. Let's give her the courtesy of doing that. I did not see her raise her hand. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. It's back on the table.
Mr. Chair, Representative Soderstrom, could you clarify why you want this across the board rather than just for the sex offender program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we have another bill coming through for sex offenders, and there is a parole board that's just separate for sex offenders, and so this would be a parole board that would look at all other offenders. inmates.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, so then, Mr. Chair, this is a dramatic change then. This isn't just, with this amendment, we are saying that we're doing away with sentencing guidelines, definitions of sentences, and we're going to establish parole board? Or are we going to have the parole board with the sentencing guidelines in place?
Is that a question we could get some input from legal counsel?
We sure could.
Let's see if we can.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy and members, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission would still exist. This would be based on the sentence that would be imposed upon the offender in the Sentencing Guidelines grid, and then after the fact, after they serve half of their sentence, they could, under certain circumstances, apply for parole.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Diebel, what would happen with the sex offenders then if the other sex offender bill doesn't pass? What would happen with sex offenders under this amendment?
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, as the bill was originally drafted, there was a special subdivision that put the responsibility of making commitment recommendations on the parole board. So Representative Soderstrom's amendment takes that responsibility out of the bill, and so the sex offenders would be eligible to apply, but whether they'd be granted parole is seems quite doubtful.
But Mr. Chair, Mr. Diebel, everybody would be eligible to apply.
Mr. Chair and members, correct.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I won't belabor this anymore, and this is the way the author wants it, but this is a significant change in how we are sentencing and changing the methods of changing sentences once they are in prison. And this is a major, major issue. And I'm not sure that we can dismiss it as just part of an agenda. I think this is a crucial issue that takes interim study. But that's beyond the amendment, and so I'll shut up.
Well, that amendment, thank you for bringing the issue up. The amendment is before us. I think what I'd ask the author to do is maybe we'll just hold the amendment till the end of your presentation and discussion and see if there's any additional information that we get out of the testimony and or if there's any additional questions that any one of us have. So why don't we just hold off? I'll lay the amendment over, and then let's get on with the testimony and your presentation.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. We're here today to hear about House File 928, known as the Parole Board Bill. Briefly, the main elements of this bill are that the board would be comprised of 5 members, and the governor would appoint 4 of those members, and 1 member would be unclassified officer of the Department of Corrections appointed by the Commissioner of Corrections, and a 3-member panel may constitute a quorum. Then the following people would be eligible to apply for parole. Of course, applying for parole doesn't mean that you get parole, but applying for parole. A person 60 years or older who has served 3 years, minor certified as an adult, someone sentenced to an indeterminate term, someone sentenced for a drug offense, someone sentenced for crime arising out of chemical dependency, and someone sentenced for conspiracy, and so forth, and someone sentenced for crime based on consequences that was not proven to be intentional, and then for a commercial crime. So, and also if there's been a profound change in the individual's character and conduct since the time of offense. It is very important to keep in mind that eligible offenders may apply for a hearing, but it doesn't mean that they'll automatically receive parole. And so I'm going to start with my first testifier, and because we had such short notice of this hearing, several of our testifiers were unable to adjust their schedules and be here today, and I have letters in your packet from some of them. Our first speaker today is Sister Andrea Lee. She's president of St. Catherine's College. She has kindly taken time away from another group meeting, and she has to leave as soon as she's finished testifying here, but I think maybe she could take a question or two.
Representative Soderstrom, before we move into that, you in your presentation, you indicated that a prisoner's drug dependency or chemical dependency would be a reason that the parole board could use to assess early release. Is that correct?
Are you talking about the amendment? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Well, no, I'm talking about your testimony and the bill
okay.
Before us.
I...
Is that one of it? Where is it? Is it in the bill? Can you find it? I'll look.
Yeah, I have it here, but... Are you talking, Mr. Chair, page 3, line 12?
That may be it, Representative Soderstrom. Is a crime arising out of chemical dependency a grounds for the parole board to consider in paroling an individual? On section 2, beginning on page 2, the corrections board may parole an individual sentenced to confinement and then it lists some reasons that it could do that, and down on line 12, if for a crime arising out of chemical dependency. So the way I read is that the power board, and I'm asking, does the parole board have the ability to parole someone if they have a chemical dependency at the time of the crime, or yes or no?
Well, Mr. Chair, you have to. Maybe if there were some examples of a crime, maybe an assault of some sort, because somebody was drunk.
I'll hold my question until the public defender comes forward, because I was going to have a follow up. Why don't you go ahead and with your testimony?
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Smith and Representative Soderstrom. My name is Sister Andrea Lee. I'm the president of the College of St. Catherine, and I'm here to urge you to establish a parole board within Minnesota by passing House File 928. In many cases, the possibility of parole is a positive motivator for inmate rehabilitation, a chance for offenders to serve an appropriate sentence and following hard work to reorient attitudes, consider consequences of their criminal action, and develop skills to enable gainful employment after release, be paroled, and given a chance to reenter society as productive members. My support for this kind of legislation has developed over a period of years and coalesces most intensely around two personal experiences. The first is that I am a crime victim. My religious sister, the dean of our college, and my housemate was shot to death on our front porch in Detroit. Because her murder was premeditated, her killer was sentenced to life without parole at age 22. I know I was happy with the sentence at the time, and if truth were told, probably would have been happier had more severe punishment been an option in Michigan. But time and perspective, and I hope some wisdom, have raised serious questions in my mind about the quality and integrity of a society whose laws refuse, after suitable time, to consider evidence of rehabilitation, personal transformation, and remorse that inspires constructive action to become a productive member of society. He is now 44, and I don't know if the man who took my sister's life has been rehabilitated, but if he has, at some point, consideration for parole should become an option. My second experience is here in Minnesota. It is more recent and involves a situation which, while tragic, is not complicated by premeditation. It involves a young man who made a serious mistake because his judgment was clouded by drugs. Another young man paid for their collective stupidity with his life. Andrew is now serving a long sentence. His remorse is absolutely clear and has turned itself into productive personal transformation that began while he was still in jail awaiting sentencing. I asked his parents if they thought it might help if I taught Andrew a college class through the mail. Andrew had never been much of a student, but you would be shocked, as was I, at the rapid development of his academic skills and the corresponding change in his attitude about himself and his eventual future that his hard work had brought about. With the help of other professors, after serving only 18 months in his long sentence, he has completed 15 college credits through the mail with a straight A average. While good grades do not constitute rehabilitation, they are indicative of positive motivation and determination to be ready when the time comes for his release. Should these offenders pay an appropriately heavy price for their actions? Without doubt. Will the state, the victim's families and friends, or the offenders themselves be well served by lengthy prison sentences that exclude any possibility of redemption, transformation, growth, and constructive remorse from the equation? I do not believe so. I am not naive. Consideration for parole should never be automatic. It should be excluded for some crimes, and I believe definitely so for repeat crimes. But for the first-time offenders, for crimes committed while in an impaired state, or for crimes that result in unintended consequences, and especially in the case of inmates for whom there has been a profound change in character or conduct since the time of the crime, a good society should consider and act in view of such new realities, and our laws should make that possible. Parole possibility is a good thing for Minnesota for these reasons. Well-constructed and trained parole boards have the capability of acting in the state's interest in the same way that juries do. As a body, they can direct wise, thoughtful, and discerning eyes toward the accomplishments and attitudes of offenders who have successfully rehabilitated themselves. The possibility of parole introduces hope and motivation into a system that has precious few opportunities for those humanizing values. The possibility of parole takes into account that a young offender faced with the options of a trial with an uncertain outcome for a more serious offense may plead to a lesser offense and thereby forego the option of explaining extenuating circumstances that, if they do not alter the effects of the crime, certainly may speak to the intent underlying it or lack thereof. The possibility of parole offers economic benefits to the state when offenders who have rehabilitated leave the system with the capability to rejoin society as contributing members. Most importantly, an option for parole, coupled with fair and evenly applied sentencing guidelines, provides for an effective criminal justice system that appropriately combines justice, mercy, and wisdom. I urge you to use your power to create possibility, to trust the wise judgment of good people, to encourage rehabilitation and transformation that allows people to move into new and constructive space. And I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Sister Lee, thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? Very good. Thank you again. Mr. John Coleman.
Okay, and while Mr. Coleman is coming to up here, I'm going to would like to direct you to some letters that I got. And Judge Dennis Shaleen from Winona has written a very interesting couple pages that he sent to me. And I'd just like to show you or read to you paragraph 3 from that letter. It says, "For those caught and convicted, we must make this simple choice. If we fear them, we must lock up dangerous offenders to protect society, not to change them. For those that make us angry and frustrated and who will return to society someday, we must forego the natural urge to retaliate and use instead whatever means available to make them useful citizens. Prisons do not rehabilitate. In fact, they make chronic losers worse rather than better because they gather together people who have the same faulty belief system, resulting in reinforcing each other's erroneous views of how the world works." And so he is a very, Judge Shaleen has been, he teaches, he's a teacher, and he's taught sentencing at the National Judicial College for the last 28 years and knows a lot about this subject. A very very well written letter, and I think that you all need to read that.
Mr. Coleman, welcome. Give us your name and then proceed.
My name is John Coleman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a master's degree in community counseling. I'm a licensed psychologist and a board-certified chemical dependency counselor. For the past 34 years, I've worked with children and families. For the first 14 years of my career, I did live-in and group homes. During that time, my wife and I had over 1,000 children live with us. I've seen the changes in our system over the last 34 years. And anyone who says things aren't better for children today than they were 34 years ago isn't paying attention. Anyone who says, however, our treatment of juveniles in the court system is not worse is also not paying attention. We say awful things about our children and then are surprised when they act that way. That's a quotation from Gisela Kanapka. The evidence is clear that what we're doing now does not work. My primary concern in testifying today is the placement of juveniles in adult prisons. Our response has been to do more of what we're already doing that we know doesn't work. We provide longer sentences, less opportunity to learn pro-social skills, and no recognition of individual efforts of persons incarcerated to change their behavior. One of the reasons we say we place children in adult prisons is to decrease crime. In fact, a child placed in adult prison has a 30% higher rate of recidivism and reoffends twice as quickly as someone placed in juvenile facility. Children placed in adult prisons are 7.7 times more likely to commit suicide. They're 5 times more likely to be sexually attacked or raped. Juveniles often receive, or most often receive, longer sentences for the same crime that an adult commits. In 83% of the cases, juveniles receive a longer sentence than an adult for a similar crime would receive. So not only are they receiving longer sentences, but under our system in Minnesota, they're serving longer. It also ignores, our current system ignores the medical evidence that clearly demonstrates that children are different from adults physically and emotionally. Without a parole board, we are state that increases the damage that adult facilities do to children, makes no attempt to differentiate between violent and nonviolent offenders in determining options for parole, ignores the possibility of rehabilitation, and just as importantly, the need to keep some offenders in prison longer than the current, I believe, 2/3 of their sentence. It ignores the research that says there's no connection between long sentences and low recidivism rates. It denies the impact of maturing physically and an increased ability to make decisions that continues until the mid-20s, and it ignores individual differences. Gisela Kanapka was a world-renowned advocate for the humane and effective treatment of children. She was raised in Germany and worked in the anti-Nazi underground. She was imprisoned in the camps for the crime of being Jewish and because she thought people should have free speech. Most of her family died in the camps. She came to the United States and was a gift to all of us. The last time I met with her before she died was the first time I ever heard her mention Adolf Hitler. And what she said was, "This Hitler, I don't know if I could have helped him, but I would have liked to have the chance." It's a sad commentary on our system that we do not have the forgiveness or allow the possibility of change that Kanapka was willing to allow for the person that was responsible for her imprisonment and the death of her family.
Very good. Thanks, sir. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Coleman, did the figures that you give about the effect of children in prison, were they Minnesota figures or were they national figures?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, one of the things that I find in researching this subject and is mentioned constantly in research is the lack of research on the impact of children in prison. Sadly enough, it's not something we pay much attention to. The majority of them were national studies, I don't think any of them were specific to Minnesota. My personal experience the last 20 years or so is specific to Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Coleman, did you weigh in on the EJJ fight at all, and when we tried to keep that language into the onto the law so that children would not have to be tried as adults?
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, yes, I did. One of the tragedies or one of the pleasures that I have on a daily basis is seeing different counties, different attorneys, different county attorneys making different recommendations based on their personal feelings rather than on the actions of the juveniles. And it's not unusual for someone who's done 30 felonies to be referred to EJJ status and end up in the group home that I'm currently working in, and someone who's done 5 felonies of an equal type to be referred to adult court. So I'm very much in favor of the EJJ status for children.
And Mr. Chair, Coleman, I am too. And that's why I don't quite understand what you're saying about without a parole board, we are a state that ignores and makes no attempt and so forth. Because it seems to me in the community correction counties, there's a lot more services given to children in trouble, children that have broken the law, and children in their sentencing than in perhaps some of the other counties. And I don't understand how the parole board would affect that at all.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
Representative Murphy, when children are sentenced to adult prison, they receive adult services. I think most of us would agree that the services in adult facilities do not come close to matching those in juvenile facilities. So the parole board would provide the advantage of being able, at least under Representative Soderstrom's bill, of being able to offer them the opportunity to earn parole after 5 years rather than after the current, I believe it's 2/3 of sentence.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to remind you and of the committee of the bill that was passed as part of the Bondi bill in the early 90s that established the juvenile, what were they called, secure juvenile facilities in every area of the state, with communities working together, counties working together, so that every single area of the state had the opportunity to participate in developing a plan for juveniles and keep juveniles in secure facilities across the state, and they could meet the needs of the students, of the children that were in conflict with the law over the period. And it seems to me that in the reports that we've received back, that we made great strides in treating juveniles. And I don't know that... I'm not aware, but perhaps research has some records of how many juveniles per year are handed over into adult court. I would like that statistic before I vote. Ms. Toombs, do you have that information?
She's nodding yes. Excuse me. I think we should get her up here now since we're at this juncture. Were there any more questions of Mr. Coleman? Go ahead, Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Coleman, could you speak about adolescent, post-adolescent decision-making? Is there anything in your work you've come across that tells us something about how young adults and older teenagers think that is different from those of us maybe in our later 20s and above that might mitigate something that they did, even if it's a horrendous thing?
Right. We live in an exciting time in terms of our ability to study the human brain, not just with CAT scans, but with resonance imaging, and the evidence is very clear. I think it'd be very difficult to find a neurologist who would disagree that the brain of a 20-year-old and the brain of a 30-year-old are very, very different, in particularly in terms of the ability to make rational decisions and the ability to make a decision quickly. It's actual physical growth in the brain, a physical increase in the pathways that connect various parts of the brain. So when someone is 18 or 19, and I think most of us can remember decisions we made at that age, that we don't make decisions as well as we do now, and that our decisions then, as now, are much less based on the consequences than they are on our own recognition of our moral values, which is another aspect that children increasingly aren't aware of how morally wonderful and gentle they are, and often act against their own moral beliefs simply because their lack of experiences convinces them that it doesn't matter. Thanks.
All right, Ms. Dooms.
Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, Representative Murphy, restate the question.
Ms. Toons, I was just wondering if you have statistics on, in the last few years, how many adolescents have been remanded to adult court and adult prison sentences in adult prisons?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, there's two ways in which juveniles can enter our system. They can be certified as adults, in which they are actually tried as an adult and then incarcerated. They can also be tried as an EJJ, extended juvenile jurisdiction, where they receive simultaneously adult and juvenile sentences. And the adult does not become active unless the juvenile sentence is revoked and then the adult. I can get you figures on both the EJJs and the adults that we've had. For how many years would you like?
Let's say the last 5 years.
Okay, the last 5 years. And do you want them by any special gender, geographic location, blue eyes?
Whatever way you pull them out is fine with me. Just so I know how many juveniles have been certified as adults. That's the most important one. There's not very many EJJs. I know that. And it's when we stopped spending the money for EJJ, it became even smaller. So there's not very many. But I was very proud of a judge last month that used the language and up north and certified someone as an EJJ. And I think that was a good thing to do.
Representative Murphy, I will get you 2000 to 2005 by urban versus rural versus suburban.
Thank you.
I think there is a difference there sometimes in the way they are prosecuted because of the geographic concentration of juveniles.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. John Stewart.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members, I'd like to point out that there's another letter in your packet from the University of Minnesota, and it's from Dr. Kendra Bierrocker, and she's done a lot of research also on juveniles and their brain development. And one of the highlights here, she says, adolescents look only to the immediate future with a time horizon of 1 to 3 days. And so that's one of the, and she has a very interesting letter, and I would appreciate if you would read that. Thank you.
Very good. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is John Stewart. I'm the State Public Defender. I want to thank Representative Soderstrom for carrying this bill and for inviting me to testify here today. First of all, I think most of us in this room would agree, based on our life experience, whether we work in criminal justice or not, that people can change. I think just about anybody that knows somebody that's gotten involved in AA could get up here and testify to that. And I think what this bill does is that it recognizes that people can change, and that especially as prison populations grow and grow, the system needs some flexibility so that not every individual is going to serve all of a sentence that was imposed automatically off the grid. The bill uses the guidelines as its basis, but not as the final word on every individual, so that certain people might serve a smaller proportion of their guideline sentence by convincing the parole board that they would be safe on a supervised status back in the community. I would like to mention to the committee that states around the country are changing, and I gave Representative Soderstrom a report to pass out summarizing changes in sentencing. Has that gone up? This is a report done a year ago by the Vera Institute of Justice that showed that in the 2003 session, 13 states increased their parole options, and 7 other states reduced drug sentences, and 5 other states started sentencing study groups to determine how they could make some of those changes in the future. So people around the United States are going through the same situation that we're seeing in Minnesota, where there have been rapid growth of people in prison, particularly people with drug cases. Now, Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd go back to your question about could a person who was chemically dependent at the time of their crime apply for the parole board? And I would say under the language of this statute, yes, they could, after they served half of their guideline sentence, and then they would have the job of convincing the parole board that parole should be granted. And of course, if you adopt the amendment that was offered this morning, the parole board would have the option to send that person to a secure chemical dependency treatment facility. So they'd be doing half their prison sentence plus secure chemical dependency treatment. Finally, Mr. Chair and members, I'd just like to offer to you that this option in the bill of bringing back a parole board feature is a good tool to go with some of the other justice bills that you're considering this session. I was here 2 weeks ago for the discussion of House File 572 on methamphetamine, and a lot of people were looking for some means to provide treatment and to provide some balance and to provide some incentives and some hope to individuals who get long prison sentences for drugs. And I think, Mr. Chair and members, this bill would be part of that package. It would fit together real well with some of the other things that you're doing this year.
Mr. Stewart, the chair has a question. You referenced my question. The bill does give then an early out or a parole or an early out to someone who committed a crime arising out of a chemical dependency. So if someone's chemically dependent and a felon, they would have an early out or a parole. Is that that's correct?
Mr. Chair,
grounds to apply on that basis, at least.
Mr. Chair, first, yes, that's right. It would be grounds to apply. And secondly, the felony would have to be found to have been related or caused by the chemical dependency. So we see a lot of instances of people that get into a fight in a bar, and they hurt somebody worse than they ever would have wanted to if they'd been sober. For instance, just to give you one example. It wouldn't just be chemically dependent and a felon. There would have to be some causation shown in between the crime and the chemical dependent status.
Mr. Stewart, I'm looking at a copy of a presentation we received from the Minnesota Department of Corrections January 11th of this year. And the offender profile in the Department of Corrections is 11% drug offenders and 32% DWI felons. So that's 43% whose crime arose out of chemical dependency, or at least arguably. So I'm looking at the potential of 43% of the felons in Minnesota having an option for an early out. That would be a correct statement.
Mr. Chair, I believe you're right. They would have the option to apply to the parole board. But but they would have to serve half the sentence right. first, and they would be possibly subject to being transferred to secure drug treatment.
If the amendment were to pass.
Yes, sir.
Questions? Further questions? Representative Ellison and then Newman. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Stewart, over the course of years, you've been an advocate for equity and fair treatment of all people in our state in the criminal justice system. Are you concerned that by adopting a parole board, we will be moving away from the sort of equal treatment that we were striving for under the guidelines? In other words, will the parole board let some people out whose society may, you know, look as more amenable, and other people who historically have been looked at as not so amenable? I mean, if you know what I'm trying to say, will we find racial economic disparities if we adopt this provision?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, I've been on the Supreme Court's Racial Fairness Implementation Task Force since 1991, and when we issued our report 12 years ago, we found that the ratio of incarceration rates for African American and Caucasian offenders was in the area of 16 to 1. Over the last 12 years, under the guidelines, it's gone up over 20 to 1. So I had great hopes for the Minnesota sentencing guidelines reducing racial disparity. And I'm sad to have to tell you this morning that I don't think that that really took place, at least as measured by the reports of the disparity year after year. So I would hope that with the system here of the appointments of the parole board members and the things that they have to consider, that we would see the parole board be a measure of increasing equity in sentencing rather than to continue to have the racial disparity in prisons grow and grow.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stewart, I want to go back and follow up a little bit on what the question Chair Smith was asking concerning crime arising out of chemical dependency. For instance, for the purposes of this bill, if we had somebody that was high on meth and committed just an atrocious crime, would they be eligible to apply for parole?
Mr. Chair, Representative Newman, as I read the bill, yes, they would, subject to having to serve half their sentence and then apply and have all the facts be considered.
Representative Newman.
So, Mr. Stewart, when we are looking at that particular provision where chemical dependency is involved, and it's already been pointed out, 43% of the people, people do really stupid things when they're drunk or high on drugs. It's almost like an omnibus clause where we're gonna allow just about anybody that's involved in drugs or booze to apply for parole, correct?
Mr. Stewart.
Mr. Chair, Representative Newman, if their crime came from the chemical dependency, and if I may add something to this, I'd respectfully suggest that the prison sentences for people that actually go to prison in Minnesota all doubled in 1989, or just about all of them doubled. So now this bill would say if they serve half of the doubled sentence, then they can apply for a chance to go to secure drug treatment. So there are a lot of steps along the way here before there would be a mass release of chemically dependent prisoners. I would think that the parole board would want to see that they had been very, very successful in treatment.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One final question, Mr. Stewart. There is one provision in here that says that an individual could apply for parole if there has been a profound change in the individual's character or conduct since the time of the offense. Could you give me some idea as to what the definition of profound change in character and conduct would be?
Mr. Stewart.
Mr. Chair, Representative Newman, I can't envision all the situations, but we've seen people, for instance, who have served 8 or 10 years in prison and then have had a change that has led them to become volunteer tutors for illiterate prisoners or to do community service above and beyond what they've been required to do by the courts, or have shown in some other way that their character has been transformed, perhaps accompanied by what Mr. Coleman was talking about of the improvement of decision-making ability in the brain as they age. I've had a lot of letters from clients who have gone to prison that I haven't had a whole lot of hope for, but after a few years have shown really the ability to change.
Just as
Mr. Chair, Representative Newman, personally, I've got 3 or 4 friends that have been active in AA, and I don't think that they're tricking anybody. I think that they've really changed their lives, and I believe that my clients can do that too.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart.
Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. Let's move along to Tom Johnson. We have 4 more witnesses. We're going to conclude our testifying within the next 10 minutes. So, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll speak very fast.
Thank you.
I'm president of a nonprofit organization called the Council on Crime and Justice. For the last 50 years, the council has consumed itself with addressing the causes and consequences of crime. The House File 928 is consistent with the legislative principles adopted by the Board of Directors for the Council, but perhaps most importantly, I'm here today with the endorsement of 5 previous commissioners of the Department of Correction. They are in order of service to the state of Minnesota: Ken Schoen, Jack Young, Orville Pong, Frank Wood, and Fred LaFleur. These 5 commissioners served the state for over 4 decades. They all are highly regarded, well-respected professionals. I think that their support for House File 928 speaks volumes and that it should be weighed heavily in your consideration. Mr. Chair, I was a Hennepin County attorney at the time that the sentencing guidelines were enacted in Minnesota. And there was a period of time, grousing notwithstanding, by myself and a few other county attorneys, that the sentencing system in Minnesota, I think, worked really quite well. Then toward the late 1980s, there was a major policy shift, and the sentencing policy became much more punitive. I had some role to play in that. I'm here to tell you today. Without debating whether that policy shift was right or wrong at the time, I don't think that anyone really foresaw what the consequences of that policy shift would be. Today we know what they are. We know that the prison population in Minnesota has increased 4-fold. We know that drug offenders have gone from being a handful of inmates in our prison system to the largest group of inmates in our prison system. And we know that we have an aging population within our prison system. Now all of this comes at tremendous cost, cost to the state of Minnesota and to each and every one of our citizens. There is no one that isn't impacted by this policy shift. The Council on Crime and Justice believes in a balanced approach to the causes and consequences of crime. We believe also that that there is now an imbalance, that prison cells have won the tug of war with classrooms, and that over the long term, that will not serve public safety in the state of Minnesota well. House File 928 takes a step toward restoring that balance. And as such, we think it should be approved.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Johnson? There are none. Thank you again. Dan Scott, Federal Public Defender.
I'm Dan Scott. I'm the Federal Public Defender. I don't get here too often because I practice in federal court. But we had, and I practiced as the federal public defender for about 27 years, and before that I was a federal prosecutor prosecuting federal cases. And I think I was called here because for about half of my practice, if not longer, and even up until today, we've had a parole system until the late 1980s, and people are still on parole, still being supervised in our system. The federal system, like the state, has changed. we have gone a 6-fold increase in the number of people in prison compared to the 1970s, and about a 3-fold increase since the introduction of the guidelines. I don't think that we have gotten, based upon my experience, any better at predicting on the day of sentence which people are going to do well when they're finally released and which ones aren't. Which ones deserve the longest sentence and which ones don't. We have all the money in the world in federal court, so we can afford to put everybody in jail forever, and we're working on it. And we can say, unlike the state, is our people don't get out most of the time, so we don't have to worry too much about whether they're going to be rehabilitated. But I think that ability to make the decision later on, after a person has served a substantial portion of their sentence, and before they would otherwise have to be let out, is important, because we can make a better prediction then. More important, and probably the best thing out of all of it, if there's one thing that we have learned in all of our studies, is if you provide people with positive incentives, you will more likely get results. Our entire economic system is based upon it. School systems are based upon it. And we can get then more people active, motivated while they're serving their sentence, instead of what we have now, which is an automatic. You will serve X amount of time, whether you're good, bad, or indifferent. And I'm here to answer any questions you have.
We have a couple questions. Mr. Scott, are you supporting the release of potentially thousands of state felons in the hope you might get some federal clients down the road? I withdraw the question. Representative Ellison.
Did you have a question?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chair. Mr. Scott, in the federal system, is there at least a mechanism that's run through the president's office of early release of people who have demonstrated significant life change? I'm thinking of pardon. I'm thinking of commutation. And those things exist. Are they used? Do they help at all?
Mr. Chair, Scott. Representative Ellison, the answer to that is yes, they exist, and no, they're rarely used. The last president who significantly issued pardons was President Carter. There were a few in the other presidents since then. There have been a few commutations of sentence, which is, of course, where the whole parole idea originated 100 years ago, but it isn't significant.
Over here, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Scott, could you comment and give us a little bit of insight on violent offenders, whether or not they are being paroled out of the federal system, and if so, any problems with it, any successes, that type of thing? I'm thinking more in terms of the violent people that committed a violent crime when they went in.
Mr. Chair, Representative Newman, any answers would be anecdotal, but the federal system had parole for many years, and they applied to violent as well as nonviolent. Violent people served a lot more time before they were eligible, and the Parole Commission often made them serve every day if they could. But I know that that I had a case where somebody had actually committed a murder and a bank robbery, had been paroled after 20-something years. He had received a life sentence. And I unfortunately came in contact with him because he had a DWI, which violated the conditions of his release. He was the chief programmer for a successful programming company, and we actually talked the county sheriff in an unnamed county at this point to allow him to continue his programming work while he was serving his time. Because he was that important. So in that way, he'd become an important member of society. And I did his final release hearing some 8 years later when they released him from supervision, because he had otherwise had a clean record after that. And he was under prison and supervision for nearly 35 years. But otherwise, today, he would have died in the institution.
Thank you, Mr. Scott, for your testimony. Appreciate you being here. Then we have Larry Lotzer, Gateway Prison Reentry Program. Are you here? Not here?
I don't think he's here.
Okay. We have one final one. Jeff Edblad, Isanti County Attorney.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to have a few minutes of your time this morning. My name is Jeff Edblad. I have been the elected county attorney of Isanti County, Minnesota since 1994. And prior to that, my public service experience includes serving as an assistant Chisago County attorney, and an assistant public defender in Isanti and Chisago counties. And I'm here this morning as a member of the board of directors of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association and as a member of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission to voice our opposition to an across-the-board parole bill. The Minnesota County Attorneys Association and the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission are not against rehabilitation. They are not against drug treatment. Personally, I am not against rehabilitation. I have spent several years as an adjunct instructor at the Cambridge campus of Anoka Ramsey teaching classes to federal inmates, and I'm currently the chairman of the board of the Minnesota Correctional Education Foundation to provide college opportunities for prison inmates. So I am not here to tell you I am against rehabilitation and drug treatment. But on behalf of the County Attorneys Association and the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, we believe that rehabilitation and drug treatment are not appropriate factors in determining whether someone should be released. The state of Minnesota has been a truth in sentencing state for approximately 25 years since the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission was created. The purpose of the sentencing guidelines for the state of Minnesota are to establish rational and consistent sentencing standards which reduce sentencing disparity and ensure sanctions that are proportional to the severity of the offense plus an offender's criminal history. The purpose is equity in sentencing. And equity in sentencing requires that offenders, convicted individuals, are dealt with similarly with respect to the relevant sentencing criteria. Individuals that have relevant sentencing criteria in similar situations ought to receive similar sanctions. That's built on the principles that Representative Ellison mentioned a few moments ago, dealing with the principles of equity, the principles of neutrality, that the sentencing guidelines for the state of Minnesota are to be neutral with regard to race, with regard to gender, with regard to social status, with regard to economic status of various individuals. The Minnesota sentencing guidelines over the last 25 years has brought predictability to sentencing in the criminal justice system. And it's brought predictability to a number of different constituencies. It's brought predictability to policymakers. Policymakers that need predictability in putting together budgets, in determining the costs needed for running our prisons. It has brought predictability to victims. It has brought predictability to victims because of the truth in sentencing. When an individual is sentenced in Minnesota under the truth in sentencing standards, a crime victim knows exactly how much time that offender is going to be serving in an incarceration setting, and they know how much time that offender is going to be out on supervised release. An across-the-parole board bill brings uncertainty to crime victims. Crime victims don't know if a sentence of 5 years to 20 years means 5 years in 1 day, 5 years in 1 month, 6 years in 8 days, going up to the maximum. It brings uncertainty. It also brings re-victimization to crime victims, having to have these issues addressed, having these issues dealt with when offenders are bringing their requests before the parole board. There is uncertainty to the offenders as well. Uncertainty to the defenders, because under the truth in sentencing concept, offenders know going in how much time they're going to be serving. They know going in exactly when they are going to be released. Certainty is beneficial to the institution because if we have inmates dealing with needless stress, dealing with needless suffering as to when am I going to be released, when am I going to be released, we have the possibility of increased prison unrest. We have the feelings of anxiety. We can have the feelings of hostility. We could have inmates engaging in cynicism, which could lead to unrest. It could lead to violence in the prison system. The uncertainty is troublesome to me. It's troublesome for victims, it's troublesome for policymakers, and I think it's troublesome to the offenders as well. The question that Representative Murphy brought up earlier is a solid question. This is a major change in state policy. This is a change of 25 years in state policy. This is a significant, significant thing that you're discussing and dealing with. And the concern that I have is whether or not there has been sufficient studies beforehand on this. It's my understanding that no fiscal impact has been requested from the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And my concern is, have all of the stakeholders had an adequate opportunity to provide input, to provide guidance, to provide their observations based upon their expertise into something like this? There are several stakeholders that need to be dealt with and considered, not only prosecutors, not only public defenders, not only policymakers, but also victims and victim rights organizations. And I agree with Representative Murphy that this is such a significant change in state policy that if it's going to be considered, the major stakeholders, Sentencing Guidelines Commission as well, should be involved, and there should be a thorough study involving stakeholders. The comments that have been made this morning, and the chair brought up some comments dealing with, I believe, approximately 42% of the inmates in the state correctional system are there for drug offenses or for the DWI offenses. But my understanding in reading page 3 of the bill is that the numbers that the chair cited of 42% might be low, because the way the bill is written, it states offenses as a result of chemical dependency. And the 42% that the chair has brought up addresses those that are in for drug offenses and those that are in for alcohol, the DWI offenses. But what about burglaries that are committed by individuals that are burglarizing to sustain a methamphetamine habit? What about robberies and assaults that are conducted to sustain, robberies to sustain the habit, or assaults when individuals are under the influence? We've heard some talk this morning about the significant amount of drug offenders in prison. And the thing to keep in mind and to refocus on is the drug offenders that are in prison are there for really one of two reasons. If they are first-time offenders, they are probably there because of a methamphetamine manufacturing case. If it's a drug possession case, we're dealing with somebody that has had multiple probation violations and has the criminal history that brings them before the court and brings them into prison.
Mr. Edblatt, I'm going to have to ask you to conclude within the next minute. So
I can certainly do that.
Thank you.
I want you to remember that the guidelines recognize mitigating factors. The guidelines already provide for mitigating factors. The courts already have the power to stay adjudication of sentence. The court has the power to stay imposition of sentence. My final remarks have to do with the fiscal concern, that if there are financial pressures of too many individuals in prison, is the back door going to be opened and individuals let out for financial considerations? We've seen the stories from Florida. We've seen the stories from Kentucky, where prisons have been full, where individuals have been paroled early. We've seen 20-year murder sentences in Florida result in a 2-year incarceration sentence, and try to explain that to a crime victim. We've seen Kentucky situations where prisons have been so full that parole boards have let individuals out, and during the time that they would have been in prison but for the parole board, they're committing new offenses, re-victimizing other individuals. And on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association and the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, I am respectfully requesting you to support the opposition to this bill.
Thank you, sir. Questions, Representative Ellison?
I have to confess something, Mr. Edblatt. I kind of knew what Mr. Stewart was likely to say in response to my question. I wanted to bring out the fact that our sentencing guidelines haven't really brought forth the equity, not from a racial standpoint, that we were hoping to have. Maybe they have from a geographic standpoint. Ms. Toombs will be a better judge of that than I am. But I am curious to know what you think about that. I mean, we got the guidelines together to try to bring equity in sentencing. There are reasonable arguments to be made that that has not occurred. Given that that is, I mean, what? How do you feel about that? I mean, what's your response to that?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, I guess in light of the question brought out as how does it work, and in light of the limited time, I guess I would like to turn the microphone over to Barbara Toombs, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, who can perhaps provide some information to you to address that concern.
Well, at Representative Ellison's request, the chair will turn the microphone over to Ms. Toombs. Have a seat.
I know, sir. I just
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Ellison, one of the your issue with the inequity in sentencing or the racial disparity in sentencing comes from two folds. you know, when someone is sentenced in Minnesota with the same criminal history and the same offense, they get the same sentence. That's how the guidelines work. There's two issues playing into that when we look at the composition of our prison population. First of all, the criminal history. Guidelines do not correct for perhaps criminal histories that were as a result of arrest practices and so forth like that. So there's some issues that predispose how someone gets a criminal history that are outside the guidelines factors. We look at sentencing for that sentence and the criminal history. If you are arrested more often, if you are convicted more often, and so forth like that, you create a longer criminal history. That's one issue. The other is the actual legislative actions that have increased penalties for certain crimes over the period of years. And the drug offenses in 1989 are a good example of that, because they did increase the penalties. They also increased the presumptive prison sentence over the probation sentences. So with those changes then, and then you have the crack cocaine issue, which again is a drug that seems to be primarily consumed by minorities. We're seeing a little bit of a shift to that now with the methamphetamines. But when you have an offense that targets a long prison sentence that is for a commodity or a drug that's used by minorities, you do elevate that prison population. So you have all those factors going together. But again, I think that the guidelines in some aspects have, you know, addressed the racial disparity. Has it cleared it up completely? No. But I don't think it ever will. Because, again, you're dealing with criminal histories and also decisions where up until the time of sentencing there is disparity or there's decision points made all along the way. Where police are deployed, who's arrested, what are they charged with, where they're convicted. And then finally you get to the sentencing point. And the system wants us at this point to make everything fair and deal with all the disparity that happened before then. And we're doing the best we can, but is it going to be perfect? No. Any other questions?
Representative Ellison.
Follow-up question, Mr. Smith. I'll make it brief. My next question is again for Mr. Ed Blatt. I'd just like to get his views on this. I've practiced law a little bit myself, and in my view, the sentencing guidelines, the best thing they do is that they help settle cases so that when the prosecutor and the defense attorney are discussing the case, the defense attorney can go to his or her client and say, under this plea agreement, you're going to get this. And if you go to trial and you lose, you're going to probably get this. And this is lower than this, so maybe you should plead guilty or you should work it out. Now it seems to me that that's one thing as a practitioner that they do, excuse me for that. But so that's an incentive to settle a case. But what are the incentives if we were to have a parole board for the inmate? Do you think that they create an incentive for the inmate to perform better while incarcerated with the hope of one day being rewarded by a early release?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, as far as the reasons for settling cases, as you're aware, there are a number of reasons for settling cases. Sometimes it is the guidelines. Sometimes there are situations where evidence is deemed inadmissible. Sometimes there are other forces that factor onto the settlement of cases. So I guess I have to disagree in the sense that the guidelines are the only thing out there settling cases. As you're aware from your criminal practice over the years, there are a number of factors that play into how cases are settled and why cases are settled the way they are. As far as the incentive, from the standpoint, would a parole board create an incentive? I think that it certainly could create an incentive, but it raises the question that came up earlier as to the uncertainty aspect. It raises a question as to not only the uncertainty, but as to whether or not there are individuals being disingenuous and trying to play games with a situation where we've got sophisticated individuals that are coming in trying to say the right things to the parole board, hoping that that's what the parole board's going to bite on. Having a criminal practice as well, you're aware of the fact that individuals in jails talk about different judges and talk about different judges' sentencing practices. And part of the concern that I'm raising also is part of the uncertainty is there
the true aspect of believing that this is an incentive, or is there going to be some degree of disingenuousness, some degree of game playing, and some degree of coming in and trying to say the magic words that will get the green light to go that day?
Anyone on this side? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Eppelin.
Thank you for your time, and I apologize if I ran late.
That's fine. We're gonna bring this bill to discussion, to
Mr.
vote.
Chair.
Then we're doing a second bill, and then we're gonna recess in 7 minutes.
Mr.
So
Chair,
we're not gonna waste any additional time. Yes, Representative Soderstrom.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I just had. Can I have 2 minutes to summarize?
Go ahead.
What we've heard here.
Yes. Go ahead.
And there's some things that I didn't say, and I'd like to point out in the letters that I have. I also have letters from former Chief Justice Sandy Keith, who believes that we should reinstate the parole board. Yesterday, I talked to former Governor Al Quie, and he wrote a letter last year, which I couldn't find for me to submit again. But he is in favor of the parole board, and also have a letter from Judge Dean from Cambridge, who does the staggering sentencing, and he feels that we should reestablish the parole board. And just for all of your information, you know that 25 years ago we replaced the parole board with sentencing guidelines, and as a result of this and other legislation, and we have longer sentences, our prison population has quadrupled over the last 20 years. And we are presently the second fastest growing prison system in the United States, and I would not be surprised after this session and the new meth bill and the new sex offender bill if we won't be the fastest growing prison system in the United States. And House File 928 is designed to work in conjunction with the sentencing guidelines. We're not doing away with the sentencing guidelines. And I do feel that the parole board is a missing link in our sentencing structure that will serve as a check and balance to the guidelines. And it's going to keep those people that are not ready to get out will not be able to, they go before, many, many people go before a parole board in other states, and they're not granted an early parole. People still have to serve one half of their two-thirds that they serve, so they would not could not just go into prison and get out. And there are a lot of people in our prisons today that are not dangerous, and they would not be need to be incarcerated any longer. And so we are doing a damage to some families. I would think that if they are rehabilitated and ready to get out, they could be paying taxes and they could be supporting their family, paying their child support. There's a lot of issues that are involved besides just keeping them in a two or three extra years. So, and I would like to say there are 16 states with parole boards and they have full release powers. There are 19 states with parole boards that have limited powers. And all the states are looking at what they need to do because many other states have had expanding populations. And so, and the other thing, we actually are doing a type of parole. We have a program called the CIP, the Challenge Incarceration Program, and we are releasing prisoners there for up to 4 years. We're taking off their sentence right now. This is actually a parole that we're actually doing already. And the Department of Corrections reported to this committee earlier that that has been a very successful program, this early release, and they have saved over 372,000 hours bed prison days since 1998 when they started the program. And that's a savings, if you figure the per diem, of $29 million. And so I do think that the incentive, and so those that are in prison now that apply for that program, they're really applying for a parole in a sense that they save that much time. So I think that we need our prisoners some hope and encourage them to take all the education that's available there so that they will be they can apply for parole.
Thank you, Representative Soderstrom. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, I promised Representative Soderstrom that I'd keep an open mind, but on the first three testifiers, all they did was aggravate me. I couldn't disagree more. The only one that had it right was the last one. I just think back about my career, and I'm trying to think of somebody that I have arrested for a violent crime or rape or anything serious that didn't have a chemical dependency, I can't think of one right offhand. The other thing, it reminds me of a very close relative, we'll call this person, that was in Stillwater and St. Cloud, and I have this person's prison diary. And throughout his stay at this prison, he wrote mournful letters of repent and prayed and how he was going to turn his life around and every chance he had in there for pages after page. And at prison diary quits in 6 weeks. It continues at home. It was 6 weeks. He went back to reoffending again. And so just countless times that I'm thinking of, if I had a chance to rewrite this bill, I would do it and put it for burglary and minor petty offenses and something that was really had a chance to, a ghost of a chance of being rehabilitated. I would completely X out sex offenders, rape, murder, serious aggravated assault from ever have a chance of seeing a parole board whatsoever and put the other ones in there, but I don't know if it would pay for all the expense for the menial crimes, but that's my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Meslow, and then Murphy, Representative Meslow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm going to speak in favor of the bill, and I don't think it's a perfect bill yet, but I think we're going to have the opportunity to continue working on it. And the reason that I'm in favor of the bill is I look at the realities, and the reality is that our prisons are full, and the population continues to grow. We can double bunk and triple bunk. We can build more prisons. Some would have us expand our use of private prisons. Even if we do all those things, we won't keep up. And that means that we're going to face some more difficult decisions in, I fear, the very near future. We're going to have to look at options like reducing sentences for many, many crimes. And I think we're going to find that a quagmire that we should not be going into. We're going to be evaluating whether we need to increase good time for all crimes, and I would strenuously oppose that kind of a change. I think the parole board option is a measured way to deal with the problem that is continuing to grow. We're not talking about releasing inmates 2 years into a 20-year sentence. They've got to serve at least half of that time. Philosophically, what we're doing is it would be a shift. As we spend more, as there's a stronger emphasis on having the punishment not just fit the crime, but fit the criminal. And I don't know that that's a mistake. It allows for the possibility of the reform, but in the end, for me, the bottom line is that it ensures that we're going to have the room necessary to keep our dangerous criminals locked up in prison, and that's my priority, and I think the bill does more to help us accomplish that than anything else that I see.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't disagree with some of the things that have been said today, and I certainly believe in rehabilitation, and I believe in hope. But, Mr. Chair, Representative Soderstrom, I do disagree with a couple of the conclusions that you made about that it's the sentencing guidelines and the procedures that we've used over the last 25 years that are making our prisons inhabitants grow so rapidly. It's our sentencing procedures. It's our putting major lengthening sentences onto various crimes and taking crime by crime and doubling and tripling the amount of time that people have to do. That seems to me that's been making a much greater prison inhabitation. It seems to me that even though we have been growing, I would like to remind you all that we are still 49th in the country in the number of people that we do have in prison. And that doesn't seem to be changing. There's not other states that are coming down. And I disagree that we have a $29 million savings in here because I think that this bill definitely, if it moves on, it definitely has to come back, as I indicated to you in the note, because it has great fiscal implications for these state parole agents and probation officers throughout our state. We're going to need more. We don't have a fiscal notice on that. We don't have a fiscal note on the amendment. And I think, as I said before, this is a major policy change. And if this had been, if the amendment had been out, if this had been posted over a long period of time that the bill was coming up at a certain time, I can't help but believe that there would be more than one person speaking against it. I think that, as Representative Meslow said, this still needs work, and we have to have the opportunity to work on it. And it's a major policy change. It's something that we've never done in a one session kind of meeting, Mr. Chair. And if you want to send it on, I probably don't have the votes to stop it. I really urge you to request that it comes back.
Committee, I know there's another representative that wants to talk, but there's also other bills that we need to get to, and we aren't going to this morning. Representative Soderstrom, I would ask you where the bill is currently in the Senate, but I believe the answer is it's assigned to committee and there's been no hearing yet scheduled there. I believe that's correct.
I think so.
Okay. Then we are dealing with a little more severe timeline, which I have no control over. Assuming that the Senate gives this gives your bill a hearing over there, we would have, I think, until the 12th to act. I guess, having said that, there is a motion to pass without recommendation and to pass the bill and refer to GovOps committee. We also have your motion on the table. I will be making a request that whatever GovOps does with your bill, that it be re-referred to this committee. We do have the time, assuming the Senate will also act there. Then that will also give us additional time to do anything a member may want to do. Plus, the fiscal aspect really has had no hearing yet. I could lay this on the table and we could recess and come back tonight, but then that would add an additional day of paper processing. So, therefore, we're going to take up the. I would suggest you allow us to go immediately to your bill, right, and leave the motion alone on the amendment, because it will be back here, and therefore I would suggest you that we proceed to a vote on the motion to pass without recommendation and re-refer to GovOps. Do you have a comment?
No, that's fine. I already have a hearing scheduled for government operations.
In where? Okay.
It's already scheduled.
Very good. I see no further discussion. Is the motion clear? And is the intent of the chair clear once this bill is voted on? Very good. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
If chair's in doubt, I'm going to have to see hands. All those in favor of that motion, please raise your hand. Those opposed, no. All right, Chair was correct. The motion to pass without recommendation and to re-refer to the Committee on Government Operations with the request that this chair wants it back once they're done with it has passed. We're going to recess until 4:30 or the call of the chair to room 200. 4:30 or call of the chair. Meeting is recessed. This meeting will come back into order, and we will take up House File 1507, Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and there's an amendment. What? At least one, there might be two.
First, we have to get the bill before the committee.
Okay.
Do you have someone on this committee who wants to move your bill?
Is there a volunteer? I see a hand there, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
A brave soul.
Representative Newman moves that House File 1507 be recommended to pass, therefore headed to the General Register.
Correct? So moved.
All right. Representative Abler, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, do you want to do the amendments first, or do you want us to talk about the bill? One of them actually relates to a topic that's before us here. How to do with the how soon someone can shoot somebody if you're wearing a uniform. That'd be the 0432 amendment. The Peace Officers Association had a concern that they were limited, and it wasn't our intention to limit them from protecting themselves. The concern was that they shouldn't go right out off the bat, and the thinking is persuasion would work, and I was concerned that, not that they just seek to go out and things happen sometimes, and so the prohibition against deadly force was put in as a way to
soften some people's concerns. This language, I think, does it better in the 0432 amendment, and maybe you have some corners can speak to that.
Hang on just one second. And that's the only one we're looking at?
Yep.
All right, Representative Aber and Representative Newman, I see two amendments in the packet of 431 and 432. Do you have those?
431 is the one I was just talking about now, Mr. Chair.
Okay, do you want that amendment moved?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman?
As to, Mr. Chair, as to Amendment 432, I would so move. I do not have the other amendment.
Do you have 432?
I have 432.
All right, let's deal with 432. Tell us what that amendment does. Let's proceed.
Mr. Chair, do you want a witness from the Minnesota Peace Officer Association? Police and Peace Officer Association to comment about that, or because it came from them? I can tell you what I know about it, and it's kind of what I said earlier, that it's a way to clarify that they can act in the point is that they'll act with the least possible force, but they're not prohibited from protecting themselves if the person decides to endanger others or the officer.
Well, let's do this. Let's hold that, and then let's discuss the other amendment, if you have another amendment. Then we will go into a walkthrough of the bill by you, your testifiers, and then they can testify to the amendments. Then we'll act on the amendments, then we'll act on the bill.
Very good, Mr. Chair.
So is there another amendment?
There is, Mr. Chair. That'd be the 431 amendment.
And what will that do?
That adds a sunset to the
Okay, we've got those two amendments before us, at least when we so move. So at this time, take us through the bill and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill is before you because of the matter that's related to the 432 amendment having to do with the duties of a peace officer or a policeman or whatever the term is properly to help the commissioner enforce a temporary hold. The problem is that there's been a whole array of new infections that are springing up around the world, not the least of which has been SARS and the avian flu, both of which are very bad to get and very contagious. And you wouldn't want them running around in your town if somebody had. You wouldn't want a person with these running around your town. The trouble is you don't always know that or that the who it might be. When the department would have good information that a person has been exposed to, say, avian flu now, which is 70% fatal and contagious, they would want to encourage that person to stay wherever they were and not greet any people. The person may, in fact, stay there, and then the discussion is over. But if she would make it a formal situation, she would, when the plane lands, she would have had a directive issued for a temporary hold. And then the minute that got issued, she would then, in this case, since she would contact the Attorney General to get a court hearing established, and then the judge, usually Ramsey County, but it could be the local jurisdiction, would have to act within 36 hours from start to finish in terms to give this some process. In the meantime, the local public health departments are not really set up to do any kind of visiting, I guess, and so they need to have some official help to tell this person to stay where they are. And that's the purpose of this peace officer language that's in the bill. And if you want more detail not about the bill, I can let my witness give you some other just oversight. I'm not sure what level of interest the chair has, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Aggie Lighthizer. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health. And the isolation and quarantine bill that you have in front of you is very similar to what was passed by the House in 2004. There are some refinements and some additional changes. But what it does basically is provide a process that we would follow, the Department of Health and the court system, if we have people who are infected with or exposed to a communicable disease that is life-threatening and that is airborne or droplet-borne. It provides restrictions on when that power, the isolation quarantine power, can be used, and it's based on the medical judgment about the communicability. It's used for newer previously controlled diseases that are spread through the air from one person to another. Some diseases are spread before the person has symptoms. That is the purpose of the quarantine, to manage people who might be infectious before they might themselves be understanding that they are sick. Most people comply when they are told that they are either infected with or exposed to an infectious disease that might endanger others. And that was the experience that we saw in 2003 in Toronto with 27,000 people who were asked to be in quarantine. Of those, 27 people were under an administrative hold, and one person requested and then later withdrew his request for a court hearing. One example about how serious this can be is a young man who went back to work while symptomatic in Toronto, and the company actually needed to shut down because of the number of people that were exposed to him. The commissioner's temporary hold is designed for those situations where a delay jeopardizes the ability to protect the public from a life-threatening disease. The commissioner must apply for a court hearing with a total time of 36 hours from the time the directive is issued to the time the court makes the decision. The bill includes a process for appointment of counsel. With the short timelines of the process, it's critically important to make sure that process works quickly. And finally, it includes provisions for job protection, whether the person is voluntarily complying or is under an order. The job protection piece is modeled after the protection for jury duty and removes a very significant barrier to complying with medical recommendations. We believe this is an important provision for your constituents should they have the unfortunate event of being exposed to one of these diseases. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions from any members of the committee at this point? Well, give me a minute. I may have one or two. Not necessarily in order, but in reference to your testimony on counsel, I'm looking at page 6. Explain the language on lines 21 through 23. The way I'm reading that is the council appointed can take it upon themselves to abandon the appeal, whether it's representation of one person or 1,000 people. Is that what I'm looking at?
Mr. Chair, yes, that language actually modeled it after the language that's in the mental health process. And if you have alternative suggestion, we'd be interested in hearing that.
So in conjunction with, then my further question, in conjunction with the language on lines 16, 17, and what I just referenced, on advice, if the commissioner advises the council, they can drop the appeal, whether they're representing one or 1,000 people, on the advice of the commissioner.
Mr. Chair, actually, the advice of the commissioner is about protective measures for the council, whether they should be wearing masks, what kind of masks, what other kind of protective measures they should be taking to protect themselves from disease. It's not about the appeal.
On page 4, line 15, I see the word significantly is stricken.
Mr. Chair?
Just a minute. In the way I'm reading that, without the word significantly, the commissioner can order the detention of a number of individuals, whether it's one or 1,000, could detain them under the old language if it would significantly jeopardize. But with the word significantly taken out, now it only, I'm reading it that a judge would only need to see that the court that the directive would jeopardize. I guess what in your mind, how are you lessening the effect, or what is the effect in your mind of taking the word significantly out?
Mr. Chair, that was my work, and I can speak to that. I thought the word significantly, as I read it, modified the word jeopardize, and so if you jeopardize only halfway with significance, that would even be maybe a substantive with 30% level of jeopardizing, and I thought I wanted the full meal jeopardize. So I saw that taking the word significantly out as strengthening, and taking away her powers. So it had to be a general, a bona fide jeopardize as opposed to a partial jeopardize. If you think otherwise, I'll be happy to put it back. It was an effort to limit the to raise the bar as to what standard had to be met before action to be taken. I'm open to advice on that. That was my understanding.
Would you be open to reinserting the word significantly?
Yes, Mr. Chair. If you think it makes it stronger, then I'll accept your counsel on that.
I'm just pursuing a few questions. I don't know what I want at this point, or at least as one member of this committee, what I may want. Looking at page 3, give me some help with language at the bottom, lines, roughly lines 33 through the bottom. Am I correct that this would allow an ex-party order to be transmitted by email upon which the police officer could act?
Mr. Chair, yes. The intent of that language is that we can use a variety of means of getting the information to the peace officer so that the peace officer has the information to act on.
Two other questions dealing with language on page 5. Lines 4 and 5. The way I'm reading that, the commissioner could physically hold and detain as many people as the commissioner felt necessary for 36 hours, up to 36 hours, without talking to a judge. Is an ex parte order otherwise? Is that right?
That would be, I guess, the interpretation of that, Mr. Chair. There's the criteria before she can do that. It has to be a life-threatening disease that could jeopardize or significantly jeopardize her ability to prevent the transmission of that as well. There's a few standards that have to happen. And also, I did some research on that, if you're wanting some other thoughts, about what you could do to her if she did act inappropriately. And there are some recourses available if they act inappropriately. If you want to know about those.
And one last question, just so that I can understand what I think I'm reading on page 5, in conjunction with everything else I've asked, lines 25 through 28. My interpretation, and tell me if I'm correct or not, is that a peace officer, can detain someone without ever talking to a judge on the strength of an ex-party order delivered by email.
Mr. Chair, I believe that's correct.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, so Representative Abler, if my neighbor goes to, say, Hong Kong and comes home with a cough, I could be arrested by a police officer via email and held for 36 hours. Is that true?
Ms. Lighthizer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, the requirements to be considered eligible for isolation and quarantine are first that it needs to be a new or novel disease or a re-emerging disease caused either by bioterrorism or a naturally occurring disease, whether it's smallpox or SARS. It needs to be spread through air or droplet transmission and it needs to be a disease for which isolation or quarantine is an effective means of preventing transmission. So it needs, you need to meet a variety of criteria before that would be considered. Then it also requires that the least restrictive means of managing the individual is considered. So the most likely recommendation would be the individual would be encouraged, recommended, and supported in home quarantine. And if that's not possible, then we would work with them on some other kind of arrangement.
So, Mr. Chair, if
Representative Ellison.
If my neighbor comes home from Hong Kong, is coughing, and somebody thinks they may have SARS, I can be put in a locked hospital for 36 hours, right?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ellison, we would first need to have more definitive information about the individual. It would need to be more than just they came from Hong Kong, where there may have been SARS. We would need to know what their health status is. Then we would need to know what your involvement with the individual was, whether you had significant and close contact with the person. And then we would work with you to say you've been exposed to a disease. Would you be willing to be in voluntary status? And if not, then we would work with you on this other.
Now, if I said, you know, I don't want to go because I got things I have to do, then short of killing me, the police officer can do whatever else it takes to get me in custody, right? They can't kill me, but anything else they can do, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, that's correct.
Now, what happens after those 36 hours? What if they're not done with the lab results aren't back? I'm feeling fine. I have things I have to do. I'm in this locked hospital. What happens next?
Mr. Representative Abel.
If the court hasn't come back with a finding on page 5, line 4, the directive expires and you're free to go. That was we added that in to make sure it was clear that you they couldn't just delay you for an untimely time.
We have other questions, but I have another one that I found that I forgot to ask, so I'm going to do that now on page 7. Under the protections that, portion, lines 14 through the end of that page. So, tell me if I'm wrong, but the way I'm interpreting this is that the bill would grant certain protections to a working man or working woman if they were detained protection on lines 14, etc., but that there is a limitation clause that, to my interpretation, would mean that a working man or woman, if they were detained for longer than 21 days and they were fired or terminated, that they would have no protection other than to seek unemployment compensation. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, the protections extend for 21 days, which is a standard quarantine. I was silent on what happens on day 22.
Representative Eastland?
That was my question.
All right. Any other questions? More testimony? Do you have anyone else?
We do not.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler is the workers' comp. Task force or commission or whatever that thing is called weighed in on this at all?
Representative Abler.
sorry, you're Mr. Chair and you're Representative Murphy. This has been to the jobs committee. This is not a workers' comp kind of bill. This is simply an employee protection, which is not related to workers' comp. So they have not issued an opinion from the Work Comp Advisory Council about this. However, this language has been reviewed by the labor and business, and it's a bit of a compromise. I think that it seeks to serve all. Well, last year, we did not protect employers under 15 employees. If you were under 15 employer, your employee had no protection. This protection has been extended to all employees of all firms for 21 days. Last year, I think it was open-ended. And we have a finite date, which seems to serve everybody's interest as well as it can be served.
Representative Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you help me understand why the officer can rely on something like a email or a fax? Mm-hmm. I mean, It seemed to me that if you're going to deprive an American citizen of their liberty in a non-emergency situation where they're suspected of being in contact or exposed to somebody, that, you know, there ought to be something a little bit more substantial than an email or a fax. It seems like something should be delivered to somebody. It seems like some sort of an order that would be issued by the Department of Health ought to be, there ought to be a document specific that would have to be given to the person being detained, on the order of a warrant of some kind, even though it's non-judicial, it's a pre-judicial period. It seems like there'd have to be something. Why is it that these sort of relaxed, what I would describe as relaxed procedures are necessary? Couldn't we give the citizen something more to rely on if we're saying, you're coming with me? Fellow with a badge is saying, you're coming with me right now because we think you may have been exposed to a SARS victim.
Mr. Chair? Just to back up into the context, the only reason this would be put out is if, back into page 4, that's lines 10 to 12 or 12 through 20 or in that range. This is a thoughtful person or a reasoned person has good cause to think that if someone wasn't detained, that something very bad, life-threatening, would be likely to be spread to people who had not been exposed. And that's just to get the context going. And if at some point your neighbor, this could be your neighbor, and you haven't visited him yet, and you know he's got, and let's say that he's got this avian bird flu, which is 70% fatal. And there's no treatment, I don't think. There's no treatment. You want him to stay in his house. And you don't want him to expose your family. You don't want to expose your other neighbors either. And so at some point you have rights to not be exposed, and this man has a right to due process. To answer your specific question, the intention for the modern transmission of information was for time. And it's modern technology, and you can, maybe it's up in Worthington or someplace, and there's that's the biggest reason. And the department can comment if you want to.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, one of the challenges in working with this legislation is that we're working with both session law and statutory language around the sunset. The language that is not included in the bill but is addressed in sunset includes provisions for directives to be given to the individual, and it actually has a fair amount of language around how that's to be done, and that it's to be done individually, whether it's the commissioner's directive or the court order. The piece that's in this bill is about being able to rapidly communicate with the peace officer so that they have the information directly in front of them. But the individual does get a copy of the directive or the order.
And Mr. Chair, the person is given a copy of the directive on the spot.
Say again, I couldn't hear you.
Oh, the person is given a copy of that directive on the spot, so they have at least a document, that an email or whatever, so with some data behind it. But the primary interest is speed. You can find a better way that accomplishes that goal, and maybe we never need any of these powers. I was the big opponent of this 3 years ago, so I understand the problem.
I'm sure that gives us...
You feel much better, Mr.
Comfort. Discussion. We had one other testifier listed. Are you here, Twyla Brace, Citizens Council on Healthcare? Come forward, please. Before you leave, I'm sorry, did you have a question, Representative Eastman?
She'll stay.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm on page 8 on the back, and I got part of my question answered here. It says, when a mayor, county board chair, or legal successor declares a local emergency, my question was, what is a local emergency, and is this bill kind of expanding the scope of what 12.29 really was intended to be? I mean, I don't know. I'm reading it here. It doesn't get any more specific in the actual text of the law. But basically what it says here is a local official can declare an emergency, some kind of a local emergency. It can be a health emergency. The commissioner then can come in and can administer vaccines if that's necessary. And then on the bottom of the page, it says that any person authorized by the commissioner to do this is not subject to any criminal liability. It seems like we're kind of moving down a road that's a little bit... gray here. What if a child gets vaccinated and they have a terrible reaction to the vaccine? And all of a sudden nobody's there to be liable for the damages that we caused and we made this. I'm just kind of looking at this and kind of seeing what a worst case scenario could look like, understanding that we clearly want to be protected from communicable type diseases. But how do we balance that with people's individual rights as well? I guess this is my question. It seems like we're kind of in the gray area here on this page. Maybe you want to comment about that,
Ms. Lighthizer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, thank you for asking the question. This is actually a provision that is unrelated to isolation and quarantine, so let me describe it a little bit. This is, as you correctly listed, under Chapter 12, a mayor, county board chair, or their legal successor can issue a local emergency declaration for their jurisdiction, whether it's for a city or for the county, or if the governor declares an emergency for a region of the state. In that situation, the commissioner can authorize additional people to help, and primarily we've listed people such as dentists, pharmacists, veterinarians, and others who are licensed under the health boards to administer vaccinations or dispense drugs. And they would be volunteers helping out in doing mass clinics. We are required by the federal government to develop a plan to give either vaccinations or medications to everybody in the metro area within 48 hours of the president asking us to. We are working on a plan. In order to do that, we will need a lot of volunteers, and this provision provides for those individuals to help, and it also addresses issues of criminal liability and administrative penalty that apply during that emergency declaration for this one particular activity.
Okay, I guess what, Mr. Chairman, I guess what I'm reading in here, it's not talking about the president declaring something. It's talking about the county board chair. Ultimately, it seems like it's the commissioner's decision here, but this is a local emergency, not a national one declared by the president here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, it's a local emergency or a state emergency, and it could be at the request of the president. It might not be. I didn't mean to imply that it would only be at that time. But that was an example of the kind of work that we're faced with, and this was an effort to address the concerns that we've heard from healthcare providers and others who may be willing to help volunteer, but they're concerned about their livelihood and their ability to operate outside of what might be their normal license.
I guess my concern, Mr. Chair, is just that it would seem that the scope of the emergency is much smaller if we're talking about something happening with a mayor or a county board chair, and it would seem like there would be some more caution in balancing people's rights and concerns if we're dealing with a very small piece of an emergency rather than a national one. That was my concern. It just seems like we're kind of treading on the area where people are going to begin to look at this and think maybe my rights are being violated a little bit here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abel.
Mr. Representative Eastland, and I don't blame you. This is merely about dispensing vaccines or some emergency medication that makes sense at the time. Commissioners aren't real persuaded to undo all kinds of decades of professional standards and licensure boundaries for no reason. And this just gives her the authority should she or he decide it's a good idea. The reason that the criminal sanction is taken away on the bottom there is because if you practice medicine without a license, you've violated the law, and you could be sanctioned under a number of acts, a number of segments of law about that action. And so it does not undo any liability issues, nor is it the person forbidden to decline the vaccination. Just so you know. So, thank you.
Let's go to Ms. Grace. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Violet Bray, Citizens Council on Healthcare, and we were one of the organizations back in 2002 that were most concerned about this bill. And just so that you know, this bill actually went to the House floor after the conference committee and then was killed by the House, sent back to the conference committee. And part of the reason that it passed was the fact that it had the sunset on it. And now most of it is going into permanent policy, and I think that's an important thing for you to understand. The other important thing for you to understand about this bill is that when you look at the date, page 8, line 27, the sunset is that most of the bill you don't actually see. You don't actually see what you're doing, what is being sunset and what isn't being sunset. But given that this is, and I'll tell you that on this thing here, all hazard emergency response, which is actually for Representative Powell's bill, but in there is a document that we created to let you know exactly what you are doing in the Abler bill. For some reason, they attach the Abler language to the Powell information. But at least so that you understand that what you're passing in this bill, if you choose to do so, you don't see most of the language in the bill that's before you. We're at the Public Safety Committee, and so dealing with the parts that have to do particularly with the temporary hold, which has always been our concern about this bill. And, you know, with what Representative Ellison said, just, you know, picture for just a second that it's your wife at home, and she's with her one child, and she had just been to the dentist's office. And something happened at the dentist's office, and they thought maybe that there was an illness that had happened there. And so there's a knock on the door, and there's a policeman at the door who says, you know, there's a possibility that you may have been exposed to something, and is the rest of your family home? And she says, no. And they say, well, then you can't be here, because when your husband comes home, then he will be exposed to whatever you might have been exposed to. And so we have a vehicle to transport you wherever. Okay, and the possibility does exist that that could happen. There would be no court order. There's this 36 hours of waiting. There's the possibility that a policeman could be the one who comes to the door. The policeman at the door is likely to escalate anything. And so here what we have in this bill is the ability for the health department to actually take away and deprive the citizen of their rights on the basis of a possibility. And just to let you know how the possibility is, I'm going to, if you look on page 1, line 25, under the definition of communicable disease, you'll notice the words believed to be. So it's, you know, it's based on a belief. And then if you look on quarantine, the definition for quarantine on page 2, line 9, I'm sorry, line 11, the person who has been exposed, and you do notice that they're otherwise healthy, because quarantine is about people who don't show any signs of illness at all. That's the tension of people who are healthy, who are not sick. And you can see that there's a lot of wiggle room here for depriving people of their due process rights. And so we have always been concerned about this section. Now it would become permanent policy, and now it would be allowed that a police officer could come, and even though there's no court order, no judge notified, the police officer could come and enforce this temporary hold provision. So I'll tell you just one other thing about quarantine is in looking at some of the CDC documents, which talk about quarantine not necessarily needing to be 100%, not necessarily to being effective, even though the compliance is less than perfect. And they really emphasize that you have to obtain and maintain the public trust. Maintaining the public trust is not the engagement of a police officer, no court order, and perhaps taking people out of their homes, or taking, you know, keeping the children in the school and et cetera, and not letting them go. So I just want you to remember, this is not a declared emergency. This could be happening right now somewhere, it's just any day, all the time. It's in Chapter 144. It's not in Chapter 12, Emergency Management. It's in 144. It's ongoing authority. No declared emergency and no court order. So that has been our concern, and we would just love to see the temporary hold section gone away. We'd love to see the power of persuasion used, the ability for the health department to go and, yes, talk to people. Then if they really resist the idea, then go get a court order. But don't immediately bring the police in when there has been no court even contacted. Thank you.
Okay, questions, committee. Representative Abler, on page 8, line 27, on the sunset issue, I recall last year you, I believe, were the author of that had a one-year sunset date. And would you be amenable to, say, if that line read, we put 1 through 19 back in, subject it to a sunset date of August 1 of 2006? That would seem to me to address concerns I just heard. What's your thought on that?
Mr. Chair, and actually, last year, this bill is substantially as it was last year. Now, there's two episodes referred to. One is 2002, was that, or whenever that was, that we had the big flap with the Doc Mulder bill. And that bill was controversial, and I was one of the ones that helped to pierce it in the heart. And we had some good compromises, and the bill went forward with some very lean language. And many of us worked together on that, ranging from all interested parties. The bill that passed last year included almost everything you see, plus almost all the Powell bill. Generally, those pots of information are generally unchanged. There's details that are different, but as an aggregate, that bill went, I think, to 7 committees or 6 committees and passed the floor with very few no votes. It wound up in conference committee. It wound up floating around. The Senate did not act at all. And in conference, the best we could get was a one-year extension of all the sunsets that were there. The committee can do as it likes with sunsets, but the trouble with those sunsets is that not all of those are related to this bill. Some are related to the Powell bill. And because they were separated for reasons at the time, here we are just a couple of days before deadline, the full bill would not have got to all the committees in a timely way, so they were put into two different parts. And you'll see when you hear the bill on whenever that's coming up, today or Tuesday or whenever, that you'll see that it's hopefully much less controversial. This is the controversial one about the temporary hold in particular. The other parts aren't nearly as controversial as this would be taken to be, just as my disclosure. The sunset that relates to the temporary hold is the one 2009, and the practical amendment, which is Amendment 0431, moves at a different place in the bill. And so, Mr. Chair, the sunset that probably is the most concerning to people may well be the one on line 28. The department can comment on the specifics of what would happen if that sunset were changed on line 27. It's kind of a technical, probably long answer.
Well, we need to act on this bill and vote within the next 5 minutes. That was the timeline I set when we started. So give us the answer, and I'm going to open this up to motion. And frankly, the chair is not going to move to subject this to a sunset in 06, all the sections, but the chair will entertain a motion if somebody else wants to make it. So if you have an answer or want to address the sunset issue, you can do it.
Mr. Chair, as we said, this has been complicated because of session law and statutory, and it's in two bills. I think one of the challenges of sunsetting all of the provisions is the difficulty of managing the planning and the work that we've been doing with Ramsey County to rapidly be able to respond to the timeline and the process that's in here. Not knowing what we have in place makes it more difficult to plan ahead. Sunset is just would not be the department's preference.
Ms. Brace, a couple seconds response.
Mr. Chair, I guess my suggestion would be, because we are so opposed to that Section 19 Subdivision 2, to move that section up into line 27 and just include that as part of the sections that expire on August 1st of this year.
Okay, committee. We have two written amendments before us. Are there any oral amendments on this issue? All right, then we have. Do we have a motion on any of the amendments yet? On the 432 amendment.
I'd like to move that.
Representative Cornish moves 432. Discussion on that amendment. If not, those in favor signify.
No.
We'll Representative Kramer, I thought we had that discussion already, but summarize it again.
Mr. Chair, this comes from the, is it the Peace and Police Officers Association?
What is that? President Cornish, please, you might do a more succinct job than Representative Edward. Go ahead.
If you want to real quickly look at the language on page 3, line 29, and page 5, line 20. Page 329 and line, page 5, line 20. What it does is when it gets the officer into this mess and then says that he or she cannot use deadly force, and it's a liability and a safety and everything else problem, what this language does in the amendment, it just says in all necessary force to carry out the enforcement duties under this section. So necessary and lawful means to apprehend, hold, transport, and quarantine. The language is problematic, to say the least, to say that you walk into a situation and then you can't use deadly force if the person that you're working with uses deadly force. So all it does is it gives that the option by saying all use lawful and necessary means to apprehend, hold, and transport in those two places. It strikes the deadly force issue and puts that in.
So it allows deadly force.
Yes.
All right. Discussion on that amendment. Any further discussion on the amendment? Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Are there any other amendments?
Mr. Chair, the 0431 amendment is technical. It moves the sunset, which I think in the comments, and this was an addition at my request, the sunset subdivision 2, this would require that in 4 years, subdivision 2, which is the temporary hold piece, must be revisited and see how it's working. At least that way it will expire in time in a 4-year sunset. This simply moves it from, it just removes it in the, to a different place in the bill. It's already present.
Any questions on that motion? Do we have someone to offer that motion?
So moved.
Representative Mezel moves 431. Discussion. Seeing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. House File 1507 as amended is back before us on Representative Newman's motion. It will be recommended to pass. Discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Very good. Thank you. Yes.
Next through on the agenda is House File 1228. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman and Committee, House File 1228 has to do with civil legal services. It's a bill that increases funding for civil legal services through a manner that is already being used in the form of surcharges being collected on certain recording and registration fees. I have three competent individuals up here who can put this to you a lot better than I can, explain it, explain how it's been used in the past, and explain why it is needed. And then I'd ask that this bill be laid over for possible inclusion.
Okay, testifiers, would you,
Mr. Chairman,
introduce yourself for the record before you begin your testimony, and then give us your comments.
Yep, Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Glenn Dorfman. I represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors, and I guess my job is to give you a little history. Starting back in the late 80s, when Supreme Court Justice Sandy Keith used to wander the halls upstairs, he just loved the legislative process. He grabbed me one day and said, "I need you to take a walk." And so I walked with him, and usually when a Supreme Court justice asks you to walk with him, you walk with him. And he said, I need some money for legal aid, and I want to do it on the fees. What do you think? And I said, I guess you want me to take a walk. And I said, no, I think we can support this because it makes sense that half, between 35% and 50% of the work that legal aid does in civil cases is in real estate-related stuff, rental and residential. Starting back then, we've supported these increases on a fairly regular basis, meaning not a lot of increases, but two or three times, because the poorest folks in Minnesota are the least able to afford civil legal help. And these guys, I've known them for years. I trust them, and I think they do very good work. So that's why I'm here. And I strongly support and ask you to support House File 1228.
Mr. Chairman, if we can now go to Mr. Banneke and the other testifier and proceed with the balance of the testimony.
Okay, Mr. Banneke, would you state your name for the record and proceed with your comments?
My name is Bruce Banneke. I'm from Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services. Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. And I appreciated Representative Murphy mentioning about my grandkids' birthday party. My wife just reminded me that I need to get going. And I know that Representative Newman's anniversary is today also, and so I'm going to try to be very brief, which is not a strength, but I will try. I'm very appreciative of Representative Smith sponsoring this bill and the strong bipartisan tradition of support for legal aid in Minnesota. And I appreciate many of your individual efforts. We've been very blessed in legal aid in Minnesota to enjoy the strong support of the courts, of many individual lawyers, most individual lawyers, many persons from the community, and certainly Mr. Dorfman and the Minnesota Realtors. Mr. Lane, to my right, and I are going to are representing the Minnesota Legal Services Coalition, the seven nonprofits which together provide statewide service in every one of Minnesota's 87 counties. We annually help about 33,000 low-income persons on their critical civil legal need civil cases. We help thousands more through our preventative law and community education work. We've been very fortunate in Minnesota to have a strong public-private partnership of funding to support legal aid, federal, state, and local, both public and private. And because of this partnership and the work of legal aid in Minnesota, we've been fortunate to gain a national reputation for excellence. And even though we feel, thank you, Representative Smith, even though we feel good about the reputation, we know that we can do better, and so in this past year and a half, we asked the Minnesota Supreme Court to appoint a commission to look at legal aid statewide and make suggestions to us on what we can do better. I'm glad to report that Representative Meslow was on the commission and Representative Ellison were on the commission, and that report should become forthcoming very quickly. Many of you have heard me talk for a long time, and so tonight I'm going to stop in just a second and turn it over to my good partner and friend over here, Jerry Lane, and to have him speak. You hear a different voice. Jerry and I together have been in legal aid for about 67 years. I'm a lot younger than he is, so we'll have to say that most of them belong to him. Actually, pretty even. Representative Smith asked me to make two real brief points, and I will. As Mr. Dorfman said, legal aid funding has been supported in the past by a real estate filing fee in both 1992 and again in 1993 to address the well-documented unmet need for civil legal services. And as Mr. Dorfman mentioned, there's a very strong nexus between the work that legal aid does in housing and the real estate industry, and I think that's why they've been so supportive. As Mr. Lane will elaborate a little bit, much of our work involves preventing homelessness. It also involves keeping farm families in the homestead if we can. It also involves predatory lending, equal opportunity, and more and more. We have been looking at other kinds of issues, and one of them that I'd like to comment on is our work to keep housing on the market and to use the legal process to fix up substandard housing so it's safe and decent. And we, in a special project of legal aid in Minnesota, is called Project Hope. And in that situation, what we do in Project Hope is that we work with, we have what we call pro bono landlords,
and we work with families in trouble, and we try to work out solutions short of eviction. As part of that, we educate tenants on the responsibilities so that there won't be problems down the line, and we try to intervene in an immediate sort of way to mediate when there are problems, again, to keep things out of the court system. And also, as I mentioned, we do a lot of other preventative law, community education work. Our another project, Project HALO, Housing Alliance Law Office, sponsored by 3M, which has been a very strong supporter of legal aid, and Briggs & Morgan Law Firm, the City of St. Paul, and William Mitchell College. And what we try to do in that situation is when housing is going to be condemned and destroyed, we intervene, and if the housing is to be able to be salvaged, we use the legal process to keep the family in the home and to get the housing fixed up. And in the end, we're able to keep affordable housing on the market in safe and decent condition and, in effect, save everybody. There's a lot of win-win, and we're able to leverage a tremendous amount of pro bono resources to accomplish that. So those are just two examples of the housing work that we do in Minnesota and the Nexus. With that, I'm going to thank you again for your strong support of legal aid and turn it over to Mr. Lane for concluding comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Banneke, for your brief comments. Mr. Lane, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with the comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeremy Lane. I'm the Executive Director of Mid-Minnesota Legal Assistance, which serves people in 20 counties in central Minnesota, with our largest office in Minneapolis. I'd add my thanks to Mr. Bunkies for the strong history of bipartisan support from this committee and this legislature. As Bruce mentioned, legal aid provides legal education, advice, and ongoing representation in civil matters throughout the state to people who can't pay a private lawyer. We educate people about their rights and responsibilities, helping them to prevent legal problems or, in many cases, resolve problems without a lawyer. When a lawyer is needed, we provide one within the limits of our resources. We do not handle fee-generating cases like personal injuries. We do not do criminal defense. Our focus is on critical legal needs in areas like homelessness, domestic violence, access to food, clothing, and medical care, transition from welfare to work. I brought a handout and gave it to the page before the hearing. I'm not sure if he has distributed it, and I do not see him. Ah, okay. It's a five-page handout. Yes, thank you, Representative Meslow. Page three of that handout tries to give you some sense of the broad range of people that we help throughout the state, although, as Mr. Banneke, and Mr. Dorfman mentioned, housing is the largest single area of our work. State funding for legal aid is part of a public-private partnership with roughly one-third state funding, one-third federal funding, and one-third local and private funding. Legal aid receives close to $2 million a year from the lawyers of Minnesota. Equally importantly, funding for legal aid leverages roughly $10 million a year of donated time by private attorneys in Minnesota, and in most counties, the volunteer programs for volunteer lawyers are run by the local legal aid office, which does screening, training, and backup for the volunteer lawyers. Legal aid is a cost-effective investment. Some of the direct benefits are listed on the top page of the handout. In terms of reducing client reliance on public assistance, and so on, some of those benefits are consciously understated. For example, the first two items, child support orders and federal disability benefits obtained through legal aid work, do not attempt to include the cumulative benefits over the years. For example, child support orders obtained in 2004 will still be generating money for that family years later. But the numbers reduced are only that first year's benefit. The same is true with subsistence income for persons found to be permanently disabled. Keeping families out of tax-supported homeless shelters is another direct saving, totaling almost $4 million for the taxpayers each year. And, of course, no one knows better than the courts themselves how directly it benefits the taxpayers to keep cases out of the court system altogether, either by advising people who come to their office that they have no merit to a case or by resolving it out of the court system. Any school superintendent will tell you that housing instability, with children being forced to move from school to school, sometimes more than once during the school year, is a sure prescription for school failure and ultimately life failure, and that's often a ticket to prison. And you know better than I do what the corrections budget means to the taxpayers of Minnesota. A published analysis of United States Department of Justice statistics on domestic violence in the United States in the 1990s concluded that a woman is significantly less likely to be abused if there is a local legal aid office in the county of her residence. And I think we all know the price that society pays for domestic violence. We try to respond to a changing environment. At this point, my program has community education materials available in 14 languages, and I'm sure Bruce is in the same situation. We have staff bilingual in half a dozen languages, and we know the exploding need for interpreters all over the state. We strongly endorse the Supreme Court's request for funding for interpreter services because we have worked with the court on this issue and we know how important it is. We use the web to give low-income people, government and social services agency staff, and volunteer lawyers instant desktop access to all our educational materials. The fourth page of the handout tells you about both web resources. Law Help Minnesota was used by over 150,000 people in 2003, 178,000 in 2004, and is on track to go over 200,000 in 2005. And that translates into a great deal of self-help, problem prevention, and problem solving. Legal aid statewide has been hurt badly in recent years. The second page of the handout shows some of the major funding losses, along with the impact of 3 years of increased cost of delivering services. The combined impact is over $6.2 million a year. Legal aid programs are down all over the state significantly in attorney staffing, and without additional resources by this time next year, we'll be down over 20% from where we were just a few years ago. And that's despite having a salary structure averaging roughly 70% of comparability with the public defenders, even without factoring in the value of public defender pension rights. With your support, we can make up much, though not all, of the ground we've lost since 2001. Finally, I was asked to note that there is a technical error on page 5, lines 18 and 19, appropriating funds to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And while Justice Flats, I'm sure, would welcome the addition to her retirement benefits, in fact, the appropriation should go to the Supreme Court rather than to the Chief Justice. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So Representative Smith, we'll just assume that error is going to get corrected as we move this to the omnibus bill.
Very good.
I just had one question. I think you probably answered it indirectly, but I was just looking at page 3 of the fiscal note. It said a request for funding for civil legal services in the amount of $3.5 million per year for 06-07 was submitted by the judicial branch. And then I just noticed that what we're raising with the fee is $5.8 and $5.9 million on those 2 years. So it's a big discrepancy, I guess. The need is evidently out there.
Mr. Chair, the need exceeds the $5.8.
That's good enough.
I think it had been used before we knew the fiscal note.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Representative Meslow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a very brief comment that it is my privilege to serve as a member of the Minnesota Legal Services Planning Commission. And the primary work that we've been doing for the last 2 years is putting together a report that, among other things, studies and compares the way Minnesota provides legal services to the poor and to the indigent as compared to other states. We've got a chance to see how other states are doing that. There are some lessons to be learned, but primarily what we've learned from it is that it's being done exceedingly well in Minnesota and that we should be very pleased and proud of the service that is provided here. And I think this is a wonderful way to make sure that we can maintain and, in fact, improve the level of that service.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, Chair will lay the bill on the table lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the time, committee time. Thank you, gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman, then I'd like to move to House File 848, if you will.
Okay, House File 848 is before us for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Smith, go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I've moved the bill and asked that you lay it over when we're done. I'm going to just very briefly overview the bill for you and then ask Mr. Kyer to explain it and to answer any questions. The bill, Mr. Chairman, limits representation by public defenders to statutorily designated persons. It limits the discretionary appointment of public defenders by the court. It modifies the access rights of public defenders to certain government data, and it repeals a statute addressing the appointment of public defenders. I'd ask Mr. Kyer to more fully present the bill.
Welcome, Mr. Kyer. Would you state your name for the record?
Sure. Chairman and members, excuse me, for the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. Mr. Chairman, as Representative Smith indicated, it was a pretty good summary of the bill. It's actually very straightforward. Sections 2, 3, and 5 are sections that eliminate some old language that have been in the statutes that have given the trial bench or appellate court some very broad discretionary language for appointing public defenders. And as you all know, resources in this area have become exceedingly tight, and at times what has happened is we have been appointed to cases that we probably shouldn't be or where folks probably aren't eligible. We have 270 some odd judges in the state. Is it happening with all 270? Obviously not. But it is happening on a fairly regular basis, at least when we know about it. A couple of instances just to highlight. Down in the first district, we've been appointed to advisory council when people want to go pro se or represent themselves. Even though you folks 2 years ago specifically passed a bill that provided that we wouldn't be doing that. And we had a judge that's appointed us there. In the 5th district, we had a situation where a part-time public defender was appointed to an appeal of a misdemeanor case. We haven't done misdemeanor appeals, if we've ever done them, haven't done them at least since I've been around, which is a long time. So that part-time public defender had to do that appeal without being paid for it. Those are the kind of instances, and we have other ones, and can certainly go on, but I know the hour is late. But that's sections 2, 3, and 5, and it's an attempt to get back into the statute what specifically we do as opposed to having that broad discretionary language. Again, it doesn't take away from the judge's ability to appoint where people are eligible, where they qualify for a public defender in the criminal cases that are listed. Section 4, the access to CrimNet data, is language that you all saw last year at least a couple of times. This has been passed by the CrimNet Advisory Committee as well as the CrimNet Policy Committee. And I'm sure you'll probably see it in their bill that I think that Representative Smith's probably carrying this year. Again, sections 2, 3, 4, and 5 were all in the bill that we presented to you last year and passed the House floor. Section 1 is a provision. As some of you may have been contacted, this specifically impacts a number of different cases, but I think the big one that people have indicated is the representation of CHIP's parents. Parents in child protection cases. Under Minnesota statutes 260C 331, that is a county responsibility. We've had that discussion before in front of this committee, I think when we presented the budget. I'm happy to go through it again with you if you want to, but again, the hour's late and we're, again, I'm happy to do that, but I guess at this point we'll stand for any questions. All right, well.
Were there any other testifiers, Representative Smith, that you were going to ask?
Well, I see on the list Judith Brumfield, Assistant Director, Scott County Community Services, is here.
We will take her testimony first, and then we can go to questions. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Brumfield. Would you state your name for the record and then proceed with your comments?
Yes, Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Judith Brumfield, and I'm the Assistant Director of Community Services for Scott County. I thank you for the opportunity to be here today to address you with some of the concerns we have about the impact of House File 848. I'm representing today two social service organizations, both MICA and MAXA. MAXA does not have a formal position on this bill, but has two major concerns that we'd like to express. First of all, is the concern that several provisions in House File 848 would be very, very negative for counties. The best alternative is to fully fund the public defender system. A second alternative, from our perspective, would be to change the entitlement to representation in Section 1 from the child to the parent in a CHIPS action. From our perspective, the Public Defender Program is an excellent and a vital program. It's a component of the judicial system that we don't believe we can lose. The role of the public defenders play in a balanced system is crucial, and the impact of House File 848 would be to take apart this very crucial portion of the system, that specifically representation of parents in CHIPS cases. Section 1, 2, and 3 of House File contain provisions that would absolve public defenders of the responsibility for representing parents in CHIPS cases. As you just heard, another statute, 260C, would dictate that these costs, if counsel is ordered by the court, would then be borne by counties, primarily from the social service costs. At current time, the counties have lost in the past couple of years over $276 million in budget cuts or shifts as a result of the state budget deficit. Counties can't absorb any further cost shifts to the counties. In the previous year, MAXA did an estimate, a fiscal note, of the cost of providing services to parents in CHIPS cases. This was $6.8 million per year. This isn't an insignificant cost from the county perspective. An additional issue from our perspective is the conflict of interest that would be brought forth if the counties paid both for both sides in a legal case. While it won't necessarily compromise representation, it does create the appearance of a compromise, and the system itself will lack credibility if you have counties paying for both sides of legal representation. Having each county pay for representation also will be far more expensive to the Minnesota taxpayer. It's far less efficient and less cost-effective for 87 counties to create their own system than for the state to fund one single system. We'll also have inconsistent service statewide. This is a very, very specialized portion of the law, and counties who have a small representation in this area will not have the same level of expertise that larger counties that have a much higher visibility will. From our perspective, it's absolutely necessary to allow government intervention in situations where child abuse or neglect are alleged. We must protect these innocent children in these types of situations. However, it's also important to remember that these situations involve the highest level of government intrusion in the private lives of citizens. The state has an interest in assuring that all parties are heard and treated fairly in CHIPS hearing. To not allow legal defense in these instances just because parents are indigent seems at best unfair and at worst a violation of their civil rights. This would mean that in a court setting where a parent might lose custody of their child temporarily or even permanently, they may have no legal representation. They would need to speak for themselves in a very complicated area of the law without knowledge of the law. Representing county social services, I strongly urge this committee to fully consider funding the public defender system. As an alternative, we'd recommend that you change the entitlement to legal representation from a child to a parent. In a CHIPS situation, it is urgent that parents have full legal representation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brumfield. Do we have any questions from the committee? Representative Tamar.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm trying to get at what her concern is, and I'm wondering if that is ameliorated if we strike Section 1 of the bill, or does that not get after it? Does that not work?
Ms. Brumfield.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, lines 6 through 8 on page 2. Or would that not get at the CHIPS issue?
Mr. Chair, striking section 1 would certainly assist in that, but we also understand the public defender perspective that they need some ability to limit the court's appointment of public defenders in cases that may not be appropriate. Therefore, we would see making an entitlement to a public defender in a CHIPS case as potentially ameliorating both our concern and the concern of the public defender, and removing the entitlement for a child to have a public defender. At the current time, a child who's over age 10 in a CHIPS proceeding can have a public defender. In addition, they have a guardian ad litem, and it's also clear in the law that the social service who's bringing the petition is representing the best interests of the child. So we would believe that removing that entitlement and substituting the entitlement of the parent may be a better alternative.
Representative Beamer.
Well, Mr. Chair, then Mr. Kyer, can you see a way of getting at what she's asking, or is that problematic?
Well, Mr. Kyer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Beamer, let me try to address at least some of the things that were said. Clearly, there is a conflict. When the county's talking about a conflict, there's a conflict now because we represent the parents and the child if they're over 10. So the issue of a conflict is one that we've dealt with for a number of years, not only in this area but other areas. Secondly, is in this area, if this is the case, we are not talking about folks who would not be represented. Yes, it would be. It's a county responsibility under the statute, and if this language were to pass, yes, it would be a county cost. But it's not like folks are not going to be represented. Okay? We're still going to be representing the children over 10. The counties would still be representing the parents. So I don't want to leave folks with the impression that somehow people are going to be out there without representation.
Mr. Chair, is this
Representative Beamer?
Mr. Kyer, is this another example of the state shifting responsibility to the counties, because the state doesn't have enough money to fully or properly fund the public defense?
Mr. Kyer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Beamer, I think what this is a situation that you all saw last year, which was you saw this huge increase in the number of these child protection cases, beginning, frankly, with the state assumption of a cost back in 94-95. So you had a situation where you had this number of cases increasing. On top of that, you had a situation where federal guidelines, federal timelines were in place, and the Children's Justice Initiative was then put in place on top of that, which made these cases much more complicated, much more, the requirement that they be resolved much more quickly. So when the state assumed the cost of public defense, there was not a lot of thought, I don't think, given to this area. And there were about 3,000 or 4,000 cases. There weren't the timelines, as I suggested. There wasn't the Children's Justice Initiative. And so there wasn't a big area that people were that concerned about, and I think it was one of those situations where, it was left as it was. Well, all of a sudden now you've got over 8,000 of these cases a year, and you have those constraints that I just mentioned. So it isn't a matter of does the state not have the money or not? And the question, as part of it, it's also a question, do we have the resources and the expertise to do these cases? And we clearly don't. I think we brought this issue to you 2 years ago. I know the Chief Justice brought it to the governor 2 years ago. We brought it to you this year again. We brought it to the governor this year again. He chose not to fund it, and I understand, he's dealing with limited resources just like you folks are. Are these important cases? Of course they're important cases. But it comes down to a question of what you have are mandated to do and what you're not mandated to and what you have the resources to do.
Seems like I've heard this argument before.
Representative Newman.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kyer, is there a constitutional mandate to represent
parents in the CHIPS case? Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, my lawyers tell me no. It's truly a statutory requirement.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kyer, do you have any views on whether a court might have, within its inherent authority, the right to appoint a public defender regardless as to what the statute says? I mean, does this really solve anything, or can a court within its inherent authority as a judge come to make findings and say, I hereby appoint you? I know the statute's trying to not do that, but is that still... I mean, there are other areas where courts have inherent authority and do exercise it. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Mr. Geyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, I do, but I don't know if those are ones we want to talk about right now.
All right.
but to ask your question, I would never presume to speak for the court or for individual judges. You know, that's... I have a hard enough time just keeping track of all my public defenders.
Right.
Mr. Kyer, does this bill save public defenders court time or money, or how would you quantify that?
Mr. Chairman and members, under this bill, if you're under Section 1 anyway, it would reduce the number of child protection cases around the state by about 3,500 per year. Hennepin County, obviously, as most of you know, already contributes to public defender, the public defender budget there. So there really would be no change in Hennepin County. So in the rest of the state, we're looking at about 3,500 cases. It doesn't sound like a lot, but when you put it together with the weighted caseload, it's about 6% of our caseload. And as all you know, because you went through the budget process and we explained, we are looking at some significant cost implications for the next 2 years either through personnel or trying to keep the people on that we have. So.
And Mr. Chair, if I might inquire along those lines, the 3,500 caseload would be carried by how many public defenders on an average caseload per public defender?
Mr. Chairman and members, right now the average caseload for a public defender is a little over 800 case units, so more than double the ABA standards right now. So the number of case units involved here is actually about somewhere around 17,000 because of the weighted case of the weighted caseload of these particular cases.
If there's no other questions, I'd ask the chair to lay this bill over for possible inclusion.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, we will lay the bill over for inclusion on the or possible inclusion on the omnibus bill. Next on the agenda is Representative Westerberg, House File 950. Welcome to the committee, Representative Westerberg. The chair will move House File 950 to get it before us for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, House File 950 is a deal that deals with youth intervention programs. The bill modifies the program requirements, clarifies the intent of the matching fund, authorizes spending for program expenses and administrative costs, and it appropriates $2 million in 06 and 07 for the program. Just to take you real quickly through the bill, Section 1 modifies the program to include mentoring services, provides ongoing stable funding source. Section 2 clarifies the local matching requirement. Section 3 authorizes the use of up to 1% of the appropriations to be used for expenses. Section 4 authorizes the use of up to 2% to pay the program's administrative costs. Section 5 is the appropriation of $2 million in 06 and 07. And the money must be used to help existing programs and new programs in underserved areas of the state. Now, youth intervention is a successful, cost-effective approach to reaching at-risk youth precisely when they are at the crossroads of choosing the right path or a life of crime. Youth intervention programs are community-based programs that provide the most effective approach to keeping youth from further involvement in the juvenile justice system. The programs keep young people who are on the verge of big trouble out of it. And with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'll turn it over to our testifiers.
Thank you. Give us your name and then go ahead, please.
Scott Beattie, Executive Director of the Minnesota Youth Intervention Programs Association. Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thank you, Representative Westerberg, for sponsoring this bill this year. I'm here today representing the Youth Intervention Program and to ask you for your support of House File 950. The Youth Intervention Program is what we in the field call early intervention. By early intervention, I mean that the program is designed to work with youth right when they are at the beginning of starting to get into trouble. It could be legal trouble. It could be trouble at home, trouble in school, the kind of trouble that a lot of kids can get into. Sometimes these kids are right at a fork in the road and kind of deciding which way to go, and early intervention services like the youth intervention programs are designed to help those kids at a crossroad in their life make decisions that will not only keep them from choosing a life of crime, but also keep them in school, in their community, and preparing to become productive members of society. Studies show that it's not really what kind of youth intervention a youth receives that makes a positive impact, but it's the relationship with a positive, caring adult that usually turns a youth around. If we can reach these kids early, everybody wins. There'll be less crime victims, and the state doesn't have to pay the costly expense to rehab the youth. The Youth Intervention Program is a 29-year-old partnership between the state and 52 communities, and I guess I encourage you to look at the brochure in your packet that's looks like this, because if you open it up, it's got a map in there where it shows where the communities currently have these programs. The reason I say partnership is because the intent of the Youth Intervention Program is to provide funding for these community-based early intervention programs while at the same time leveraging community dollars. With the Youth Intervention Program, every $1 the state provides must be matched by $2 in community funding. The current funding amount is $1,452,000 a year, and this is down from $1,750,000 a few years ago before the state had to balance the budget. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking to you about what these cuts did to the organizations receiving this funding, but I can tell you it resulted in massive staff layoffs and program reductions. What I do want to tell you, though, is that the funding reductions resulted in 4,000 youth not being served in the program just last year. Last year, the number of youth that were served was 20,400. The year before that, when it was fully funded, it was 24,000. Before the budget cuts came, the program, it was the number of kids that were being served in the program annually was continually increasing. The important question is really what happened to these 4,000 kids. My answer to this is that most of them received no service, no education, or no consequences for their actions. Probably most were warned and released, and a lot of them went straight to juvenile court. Like if you look in your packet, I put an article in there from the March 19th, the Pioneer Press, that talks about how things are now operating in Ramsey County where they don't really have any diversion programs left because of the cuts to these programs. For those kids that were warned and released, what do you think they learned from that? My guess is that they learned that they could get away with crime, truancy, violence, and other acting out behaviors. And I would also guess that it was a minor crime that they committed, that they may be continuing to commit further crimes. More youth getting away with crime, more crime victims, more arrests, more prosecutions, more incarcerations, and more costs to our society. I want to also say something about the cost to society. In your packet, I also gave you an invoice that was put together by the National Center for the Juvenile Justice. This invoice is based on Vanderbilt University economist Mark Cohen's calculations of what it costs American taxpayers for one youth that quits school, like drops out of school, and takes up a life of crime and drugs, which is a fairly common scenario. Mr. Cohen's calculations, he estimates that the crime losses, victim losses, criminal justice, drug treatment, and related chemical treatment costs, lost wages, and other productivity losses, that each one of these youth cost society approximately $2 million. Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that the youth intervention program would only have to save one youth to come out ahead on the deal. And last year, it worked with over 20,000 youth. And it's got a success rate of almost 90%. So we know this program is saving taxpayers a lot of money. I also want to touch on one other important part that programs like the youth intervention do for kids. As many of you have probably read, and I heard it said earlier in testimony today, is that there's a lot of new research out there that shows that, without a doubt, an adolescent's brain is still developing until they reach about 22 years old. This research is showing that the area in the human brain that is still developing happens to deal with impulse control and decision making. This is why it's so important to get these kids connected with positive, caring adults in addition to their parents, because there is still time to impact the youth and help them learn about making positive choices. The research is showing that getting the youth involved in activities, performing arts, sports, volunteerism, has a huge impact on youth. And it shows these youth that hard work pays off. Youth that have these kind of experiences are the ones that are more likely to end up as well-rounded people that will be a future participant in our communities. So to wrap this up, I just want to say this. The Youth Intervention Program is an investment in our youth. We know it's keeping youth in school, with their parents, in their community, and out of the costly juvenile justice system. We know that these youth can be helped, and it's a fact. It's critical to provide them with the direction when they are at the crossroads of making good or bad decisions. House File 950 seeks an increase of approximately $500,000 for the Youth Intervention Program. Like Representative Westerberg said, it would restore cuts made to the 52 programs and also allow some additional programs to be added in key areas of the state. Now, I want to introduce a couple people that we brought today. Vicki Langamo is the at-risk counselor at Fridley High School, and they also have a youth intervention program. And also I brought along Dan Farr, the associate director of Boulder Options. Daryl Thompson was going to be here, but because of the time, he couldn't, so Dan came instead. Kind of using gentleman's rules, I guess we'll ask Vicki to speak to you first.
Thank you.
Ms. Langamo, just give us your name on the record. We're being recorded, and then go ahead.
My name is Vicki Langamo. I'm a counseling psychologist. I am from a large counseling agency called Central Center for Family Resources. Central Center services the northern suburbs of Columbia Heights, Blaine, Spring Lake Park, Fridley, a lot of the Anoka-Hennepin school districts. Our mission statement is to help youth and their families. One of the things that Central Center does is it provides low-cost counselors to most of the area schools. And I happen to work at Fridley High School and Fridley ALC. The main part of my job is I go in and I set up peer support groups with students who have been referred to me that are struggling in school, have serious emotional or mental or family situations. And they come and they see me regularly once a week. And the peer support group has three main goals. We try and help our young people understand themselves better. I teach coping skills like anger management, stress reduction, problem solving, goal setting, building self-esteem. I also do a huge chemical dependency awareness part where I teach the young people about the different types of drugs, how they affect the body, how they affect the brain, and the addiction cycle, so they are more knowledgeable when they come to make that key decision in their life. The other thing I do is I do follow-up counseling if anybody is really struggling or has a serious problem and needs to talk a little bit more about the problem that they're struggling with. I meet with them personally and try and help them through the situation. To give you some insight in the problems with funding, 10 years ago when I started at Fridley High School, my job was completely paid for by anti-drug and alcohol funds. 3 years ago, the anti-alcohol and drug funds were cut by a third. So Central Center did a bunch of fundraising and came up with the difference so I could stay at the school. 2 years ago, the funds were cut in half, so Central Center had to come up with even more funds. Last year, the city of Fridley decided they were no longer going to pay for the police liaison that's in the school, so the school had to come up with money for his salary. So they took the little bit of funding that they had to give to my program and gave it to the police liaison. Therefore, Central Center had to come up with all the funding for my position in order for me to stay at those two schools. So as you can see, sometimes we think it's just a little bit of a tightening of everybody's belt, that everybody just needs to become a little bit more financially fiscal in their choices. But with Central Center, we've had cutbacks in our federal funding, in our state, in our city, in our county, in the ability of the schools to help pay for these services. United Way had to reduce their funding by 35%. So as you can see, there's all kinds of funding reductions. So it's not just a matter of just tightening your belt a little bit. Unlike adults who have control over their lives and a lot of different resources that they can go to help themselves, young people do not. And to give you some idea, I'd like to tell you a little bit about a couple of the young people I have worked with. I worked with a young African-American male. He started coming to see me when he was a sophomore. He was originally from Africa, from a war-torn country. When he was about 8 years old, his father was killed in the war, and his mother sent him with his uncle to come and live in the United States. From now on, I will refer to his uncle and his common-law wife as Mom and Dad, just because the student did. The student came to me. He was really struggling with a lot of anger issues. Mom and Dad did not support him going to school, did not support him being an athlete, and he was actually an exceptional athlete, played in basketball, soccer, and track. They emphasized that he needed to go to work and help provide money for the family. And I worked with him and helped him work through his anger, helped keep him in school, encouraged him to stay in sports. This young man ended up being Fridley High's first African-American homecoming king. He graduated from high school. He got a scholarship and now is attending a college in California. I worked with another young lady, and she, when she was 9 years old, her father passed away, and her mother kind of fell apart after that, started using drugs really bad, began neglecting the children. The children were taken from the home and placed in three different foster homes until they finally found a permanent foster placement. That's when the young lady started to see me. She was dealing with all kinds of emotional problems from all the changes in her family and the grief of being removed from her home. Then her mother passed away, so she was dealing with the grief issues with her mother. When I was working with some of the grief issues, I found out she also had to go to court because she was molested by her uncle. So these are some of the problems that these young people have to face, and that
it's really important for them to have an adult that's stable that can help teach them positive ways to handle these problems. Our young people are our greatest resources. I work with over 100 students a year, and if I can prevent one student from going into drug treatment or going to jail or ending up on our welfare system, then I've more than paid for the salary that I get. Thank you so much for listening to me today.
Thank you. Mr. Farr.
Thank you. My name is Dan Farr. Many of you probably know Darrell Thompson from his football career at the university, and I am looking at me, I'm no stand-in for Darrell. He's a lot bigger, a lot faster, and a lot stronger. Darrell and I have worked at Boulder Options for the last 10 years helping at-risk kids in mentoring. We provide mentors for kids who are truant or who are in diversion. 85% of our kids who come to us who are in diversion do not recommit crimes. Over 75% of our kids who come to us truant get back into school and have passing grades. We currently have a grant that helps us from the Department of Education that helps us with our truancy along with some of the money from youth intervention. We were recently invited, Darrell and I, out to Washington, D.C., guests of Jim Ramstead, to talk about some of the programming that we do with Boulder Options here in Minneapolis. And Jim is on our advisory board and understands the importance of youth intervention. He's also helping to introduce us to some folks in Washington who are in the beginning stages. The president has initiated a movement called Helping America's Youth, and the president and the first lady are working on this initiative, which involves mentoring at-risk kids, and they have realized the importance of this, as the president has talked about mentoring in every State of the Union address that he has had since he's been in office. So at the federal level, they recognize the importance of mentoring. At the state level, we know the importance of mentoring. And at Boulder Options, we know the importance of mentoring. This young man here, Sean, who's on this brochure right here, is one of our kids from Boulder Options. He is 19 years old. Now he's 19. He was 13 when he came into Boulder Options. He was failing in school. He was one of those kids that was on the crossroads of life. He could have gone either way. Sean is now 19, came back for a visit last month on break. He just made it through boot camp in the Marines, and very proud of him, and he's moving on into officer training in the Marines. And I think it proves what Scott said. You know, it's $2 million for each kid that doesn't make it in our society. And that's very costly. We have, at Boulder Options, 120 kids that we serve every year that are just like Sean. Kids who can go either way. Kids who are in the crossroads of life. And through the efforts of primarily volunteer mentors, our program is unique in that we provide mentors who provide physical activities and tutoring for the kids. These adults, people like yourselves from our community, come in and mentor kids, and they are dedicated to make a difference in the lives of these youth. And we need your support, and we need the help of the state, and we also are able to leverage the money from the state to go out and raise private money from foundations and donors to support our cause. So we I'm happy to be here from Boulder Options, and I'm proud of the work that we do, and the work for the last 10 years we've served over 450 kids that, like Sean, we're trying to make a better life, and hopefully these kids will make better decisions and better choices. Thanks.
Mr. Farr, thank you. No matter how much bigger or neater Thompson might be, you're here. So thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Paymark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Westerberg, is the $4 million in the governor's budget?
Mr.
The governor's budget is $1,452,000 a year. Yes, that's in the governor's budget.
So, Mr. Chair, but it's appropriating $4 million on top of that that base funding.
No, what it ends up being is about $500,000 increase over the governor's budget, per year.
So it's $1 million over the governor's budget is what you're requesting
for the biennium.
For the correct. Biennium,
that's right.
And how come this is? Is YPA now under the auspices of this finance committee? So it used to. Why is it going to the money going to DEED instead of DPS? Or I mean, I don't really care, but.
Well, Mr. Carter can answer. Will help us answer that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, the current situation it is under DEED, but however, the governor is recommending that be transferred to the Department of Public Safety. So it is his recommendation, and the committee will have to decide on that. You know, the House will, if that should transfer.
Thanks.
Chair, Representative Paymar, I could maybe also just add that on the Senate side, they've chosen to keep it, at least they want to keep it in the economic development side. And on the House side, it's been referred to this committee, so we're sort of in kind of limbo in two different committees here right now.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Westerberg, isn't the governor of the same political party as the president?
Representative, go ahead.
Thank you. Last time I checked, yes.
Yeah, and you think that something where the president has talked in every state about the mentoring program and how good it is, that the governor would follow the president's lead, wouldn't you think that he would do that by including in his budget the total amount that you need?
Representative West.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Murphy. You know, obviously, this is, you know, it's really hard for the president to micromanage down to our level. I mean, I don't think that's the thought process there. The governor certainly is sensitive, I think, to, you know, the mentoring process and certainly supportive of that, too. To assume that everything is being done in one particular program in one particular category, I think that's the mistake. Obviously, you know, we're trying to do everything we can.
I was just kind of having fun, Mr. Chair, but this program has been dear to this committee's heart since you started here, Representative Smith, and remember Representative Swenson, who is the lead minority in the 90s, and he just knew everything that was going on with this program. And he worked very closely with Barbara Swanson, who used to bring beautiful pictures and real kids here, just like the picture that you showed to us. And I even served on the board for a while, too. And it makes very good use of our state money, and it is a very good program, Mr. Chair. And I don't know. It's working in Commerce, and I don't know why people think it should be switched around or why what the governor's thinking is. And if he wants to share that with us sometime, we should probably hear it. I think probably because public safety has done such a fine job with grant programs under the leadership of Mary Ellison. But I think we should put this in our targets at the top of our priorities because it is a wonderful prevention means, and that's something that we're for.
Representative Murphy, thank you. Representative Westerberg doesn't sit in on this committee as much as we do, so I don't think he knew that you were just poking at him and the president. Because and I'm glad you pointed out that this youth intervention program has indeed enjoyed bipartisan support. You and I have been here the longest. I didn't say we're the oldest ones here on the committee. We've been here the longest, and it has enjoyed bipartisan support, and that's why I think for some reason there's a Republican over there carrying the bill, and this chair put it on for hearing tonight so we could maybe get to where you're suggesting.
We'll see. Wise decision, Mr. Chair.
I don't see any other testifiers or any questions, so we're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you. We appreciate the time and consideration.
You're very, very good. Thank you, and everyone who came to testify. Let's move on to House File 1202, Representative Dempsey, Fourth Degree Assault Law, expanded to include protection of secure treatment facility personnel. And that gave you enough time to get to the witness stand. The chair moves House File 1202. It's before the bill. So tell us about it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I've got some good news. This bill doesn't cost you a nickel.
Good.
Maybe that's about all we've got. I don't want to be smart, but there's no cost to this particular piece of legislation. The reason why this bill has been proposed, Senator Murphy in the Senate has the same bill. And what basically happened was is that a nurse was providing services to a correctional facility in the state of Minnesota and was not a person on the employment in that particular facility. And she would come periodically and provide services. Well, what happened was is she was attacked by an inmate. And the present law, if the person had been a state employee, she would have been covered. But she was not. She was an independent care provider. And so they could only prosecute this person not as a fourth degree assault, but as a misdemeanor. Now that isn't fair. And so we need to correct the legislation. And so that's what this particular bill does. Let me just read to you is that it's a fourth degree assault law is expanded in the state. And this particular bill amends Minnesota Statute 609.2231, the fourth degree assault. And it relates to assaults against employees or caregivers in state hospitals and treatment centers in the same manner. In the same manner. This is what the bill does. It treats them in the same manner as assaults against correctional employees, state employees. Okay? And this is the same classification as assaults committed against correctional employees and so on. So under the present existing law, if there are assaults, currently they are prosecuted as misdemeanors rather than fourth degree for people that aren't employed by the state. So that's why this particular piece of legislation is before you, and it, as I said, it clears up the discrepancy, I believe, that presently exists in present law, and there is no cost to fiscal impact that I have before me in regard to any cost to the state, no, local government, no, fee department's earnings, no, tax revenues, no. So the bill doesn't, it just needs a the change of the wording in the law so that it is applicable and doesn't charge the local units of government or the state any cost in doing so. So that's the essence of the bill, and I would hope that it would be included in the final part of the legislation that will be forthcoming.
Representative Dempsey, thank you for that. If there's no questions or any further testifiers, it looks like a good bill. We will lay it over. We are going to test you on that not costing a nickel statement because we have requested a fiscal note.
I'm sorry. I stand corrected.
Stand corrected. Thank you for your presentation and your patience. We'll lay the bill over at this time.
Thank you. Thank you, members.
I'll tell you what, Representative Pepin is not here. I think someone has... We're going to go to Representative Cox. You are next. She can wait when she gets here.
Representative Cox, 1700, motor vehicle hit and run offense, petty misdemeanor penalty imposed. Chair will move your bill. We'll get a few minutes. Representative Cox, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This also should be a quick bill for you. Essentially, what this is a bill dealing with hit and run violations and creating a petty misdemeanor offense where the owner of a vehicle fails to provide the required notice and information to either the injured party or the police that are on the scene or the owner of damaged property, if it would happen to be real estate or whatever. It has provisions in it so that if the owner of that vehicle is leased it or it's been stolen or something like that, then that wouldn't follow through. And also if the identified driver of the hit and run accident that was driving the vehicle was convicted, then the owner wouldn't be guilty of this crime. But essentially what it's trying to get at is people that are maybe loaning cars out, whatever, and then it's involved in an accident. The police track down the car, and then it's the old finger-pointing routine. It wasn't me, it wasn't me, it wasn't me. So this is just a way to try to make sure, well, then if it wasn't you, then it was your car, and then we'll stop it with that. At least to try to get some, and this is pretty minor stuff, typically, where it's done, where it isn't doesn't involve, the bill doesn't involve, obviously, the, you know, severe personal injury or death or anything like that. It allows the prosecution of hit and run in a normal venue that way. So it's fairly simple.
Very good. I think we've requested a fiscal note. Maybe Mr. Carger can advise us on this particular bill. Are there any questions from any of the committee members on this or any further testimony? We'll lay the bill over. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Possible enclosure. We're going to go back to Representative Pepin, House File 1848. Representative Pepin, I understand you're going to be brief in your presentation, but go ahead. Chair will move the bill.
I didn't understand that, but that's fine. Okay, House File 1848, it simply creates new penalties for the crime of neglecting a vulnerable adult. It says that a caregiver or operator who intentionally neglects a vulnerable adult or knowingly permits conditions to exist that result in the abuse or neglect of a vulnerable adult is guilty of criminal neglect and may be sentenced as follows. If neglect results in the death of a vulnerable adult, imprisonment for not more than 15 years or payment of a fine of not more than $30,000 or both. If neglect results in great bodily harm, imprisonment for not more than 10 years or payment of a fine of not more than $20,000 or both. If neglect results in substantial bodily harm, or the risk of death, imprisonment for not more than 5 years or payment of a fine of not more than $10,000 or both. In other cases, imprisonment for not more than 1 year or payment of a $3,000 fine or both. Members, this legislation is needed because currently there is only the penalty for neglect of a vulnerable, only one penalty for neglect of a vulnerable adult, and it's a gross misdemeanor punishable by not more than 1 year imprisonment and a $3,000 fine. And to me, that's not acceptable, especially when you consider that the maximum penalty for mistreating an animal is 4 years imprisonment and or a $10,000 fine. Members, the nursing home industry and other groups have indicated they have some concerns with my bill, and I agree that some work needs to be done on the bill, and I'll be happy to work with the opponents and the committee to clean up the bill. But first, I'd like to turn it over to Captain Greg Rail to address some of the reasons why we need to create new penalties for neglecting a vulnerable adult.
Very good. On that note, Representative Pepin, we will be, I'll be laying the bill over, and that will give you some time, not a lot, but some time to do the very work you're requesting. Captain, we are laying the bill over, so please be brief on your comments. Thank you.
Yes, I'm Captain Greg Rail with the Brooklyn Park Police Department. I brought this issue to Representative Pepin's attention after an incident we had in Brooklyn Park in which a 64-year-old man was taking care of his 89-year-old mother in the home. He's moved into the home to provide her care. She has dementia and was a vulnerable adult. At some point, the woman laid down on the floor, and the son neglected to take care for her or call any help for her. She lied on the floor for 7 days in her own urine. When he fed her for the first 5 days, and then she quit eating, and he did not call for help for a week. When officers arrived, they found that she had severe urine burns on her face and side from lying in her own urine for the 7 days. The doctors told us her injuries that she suffered were life-threatening and she may die. The officers called me and asked me, what type of crime do we have here? So I started researching, and the only thing, because this was a case of neglect, there was no active abuse taking place, the highest crime we had was this statute, which provides for a gross misdemeanor. I double-checked this with our prosecutor, and in speaking with the officers, we worked several different types of crimes, and I guess we were just kind of shocked that the penalties for doing the same thing to your dog could result in a person going to prison, and yet when you do it to your parents, it's merely a gross misdemeanor with a maximum year.
Thank you, sir. Any questions? Representative Paymar.
I asked Representative Pepin about this bill earlier, if she had gotten a fiscal note, and I wonder if she has one now.
We have one.
Mm-hmm. You have one.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, Representative Kamer, the fiscal note shows $0. They say this will be very limited.
Because?
It's, that's all they have. It's, they say the assumptions, it's they assume that the number of new felony offenses will be very limited. I guess there, last year in 2004, there were only 7 convictions for the existing gross misdemeanor offense. And they have no information is available on how many offenses will result in this.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Carter, maybe Mr. Diebel, if it's just this graduated penalty, that's for someone. Representative Pepin, that's from the, you modeled that after domestic abuse statutes, is that what
it's modeled after? Criminal abuse of a vulnerable adult. It's modeled after the same statute.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Officer, is there a statutory definition of caregiver or operator?
Yes, there is a definition within the statute which defines a vulnerable adult and also defines a caregiver. It defines not only people in a facility but also relatives who have assumed the care for a vulnerable adult.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Good. Thank you, Representative Pepin. We'll look forward to your changes, if any, in shortly when we bring it back. It's now laid on the table. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Solberg, House File 325, Protective Agent License Experience Requirement Exemption Provided for Traffic Escorts. I know we did. Yeah.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much. This bill has come to me at my attention from a person who was laid off a couple of years ago from the Blandon Company when they had a big cutback, and he's an avid motorcycle cyclist, and wanted to be able to market his skills in that to local funeral directors to be able to have traffic control for funerals in just the local market. When he applied for that, he found out that in order to do that, he has to have 6,000 hours of training, and he has to be licensed as a private detective to be able to provide that service for an escort for a funeral. So this is an exemption. What it really does is ask the board to establish a special protective agent's license that would be an exemption to that 6,000 hours of training. Within the statute, along with the funeral drive processions, there's also within that statute is the within that section, it's an escort for oversized loads, I believe it is, or oversized loads. So I have with me today Mark Bremer from the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association, which are also showed some interest in this bill.
Sir, give us your name for the record and then go ahead.
My name is Mark Bruner. I'm with the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association, and I've been lobbying on behalf of the association for a number of years, and I just never imagined that we'd actually be here involved in an issue with funeral processions, but so it is with the bill and the requirement that if you're moving a manufactured home or a modular home, we represent both as an association, the modular builders and manufactured home builders, you'll occasionally need a licensed agent to escort you maybe over a narrow bridge or a certain part of a roadway. We don't object to needing those escorts in certain areas, but it does add several hundred dollars to the cost of a home because there are not a lot of these agents available or people, especially in greater Minnesota. And so what oftentimes happens is you'll contract with someone, maybe they're coming from the Twin Cities and have to travel a few hours to a certain location, and you'll have a home that's coming from Redwood Falls or Montevideo, and they'll have to figure out how they coordinate their arrival times right. If they don't, it's billed by the hour kind of thing. So the reason we took an interest in Representative Solberg's bill is that it appears to allow for the possibility of there being a greater supply of these protective agents available. That would be very helpful to our industry and as well those who are buying new homes. Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, the first request I had from my constituent was to make an exemption period and just let anybody be a funeral home to direct the traffic. And I thought that would not fly very well. So what we're asking in this is for the department to come up with a different criteria other than being a licensed private investigator or have 6,000 hours of training to be able to perform that function. I think we should have some training and some standards, but allow them to be able to do that.
Questions? Representative Murphy.
No, I just wanted to make a statement, Mr. Chair. Representative Solberg's constituent went about this the right way, too, because he contacted Representative Solberg and he contacted almost all the northeastern Minnesota legislators and asked for our support. And I think this is the solution that Representative Solberg offers to us is a better one, as he suggested, and that it's a worthy goal.
And Mr. Chairman, for the record, the constituent of mine's name is Dustin Solberg. No relation, but I'm sure he's a good guy.
I'm likely sorry, and I'm sure he is a good guy.
I've never met the gentleman.
Board of Private Detective and Protective Agent Services, if they're here, do they choose to comment? If Representative Nelson, do you have a question before we move on to the testimony?
I just wanted to say that he also contacted me last year, so he's pretty broad in who he was contacting.
The way to get things done, throw out, use the net. Ma'am, state your name and then go ahead.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity just to greet you this evening. Just wanted to clarify a couple of things in terms of what is required to become a protective agent. In the areas that were described, one of the protective agent service areas is indeed to escort funerals and wide loads. The protective agent area does have a different experience qualification than private investigators, and it is a matter that concerns an accumulated 6,000 hours of security and or protective employment experience. The board has chosen not to take a particular decision because obviously at the very core the legislature could make the decision based on policy to exclude a requirement such as this. But they do have a concern in regard to the aspect of creating a special license for which there are no qualifications and not any guidance in terms of what kind of criteria for the special license would be set forth. So just to ensure that there's an understanding about that, we would appreciate the ability to share that information with you.
Okay. Any questions or comment at this point? Anything further? Representative Menzel.
Mr. Chair, I was just thinking for the record, I don't think that the testifier identified herself.
You beat me to the punch.
I apologize. Marie Oldman, and I am the Executive Director for the Private Detective and Protective Agent Services Board.
Anything further? Very good. Representative Solberg will lay it over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Appreciate that very much.
Very good. Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, do you know if anyone knows how to turn these on?
Pardon?
Does anyone know how to turn this whole thing on? I'm violating the first rule of presentation. I didn't come down here and test this little thing first.
Well, you are. You're starting to talk without being recognized.
Oh, it's
your first issue to deal with. Also, I think the chair it has to suggest that the record should reflect the chair moved the last bill. Without objection, the records will so reflect. Representative Garofalo will try to accommodate your electronic needs if they're limited.
I swear I do work on computers for a living. I'm not making it up.
Was he? Not on my sheet. Why don't we have this dated so when they change by the date? Home movies.
Chairman, my apologies.
Chair moves House File 971. It's before us. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Being respectful of the committee's time, I'll try to be brief. In child pornography cases, the instrumentality of a crime is the computer. Currently, the manufacture of child pornography is a designated offense. However, the forfeiture of personal property used in the commission, the possession, and distribution of pornographic works involving minors is not. Without an applicable forfeiture provision, a law enforcement agency is obligated to return a seized computer to a defendant once it is no longer needed as evidence. Specifically, contraband files, those containing child pornography, cannot lawfully be returned to the suspect. Therefore, law enforcement must undertake the complicated and expensive process of extricating the contraband files from the non-contraband files. The cost is borne by the government, even if the computer owner has been convicted of child pornography. This bill would correct that and allow the computer to be seized in those cases. We have a testifier here to elaborate a little bit further on the legislation.
Sir, state your name and then go right ahead.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Rick Anderson. I'm a commander with the St. Paul Police Department, and I'm the head of the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. Our task force is one of 45 across the United States. We're funded through a grant by the Department of Justice, and the focus of the task forces are to combat child pornography being distributed via the Internet, and also to pursue those individuals that are using the Internet to meet our children for sexual purposes through chat rooms and instant messaging and the like. In Minnesota, we currently have 12 other law enforcement agencies affiliated with us, and I also have the state of South Dakota affiliated with our task force. We routinely receive phone calls from prosecutors and sheriffs and law enforcement agencies around the state upon completion of a case, wondering why they have to give these computers back to the guys that have been convicted of these crimes. Currently, the way the law is, they have to do that. We have to strip that data off the computer, as was stated by the representative. And this does create a burden for us as far as our forensic time and capabilities. The BCA, for instance, only has one computer forensic examiner for the entire state of Minnesota. They refer all of their child pornography cases to us. I have one full-time and about six part-time computer forensic analysts to do this work. Our current backlog is about 6 months. It really, we support the bill in the fact that it doesn't make a lot of sense to give the basic tools used by the offender to commit the crime back to him after he's been convicted.
And Mr. Chairman, what I've set up here is just a quick demonstration to so you show you one of the problems we're dealing with in terms of returning the computer back to the offender. What I've done is I've set up a directory here using files that have a BMP extension on them, commonly referred to as a bitmap. And you see when I open this up, you see a picture of my son and daughter from many years ago. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to enter one command in here on my computer. And now what has happened is all these files that were previously listed as bitmap files, you now see have extensions of .sys. Now, any computer technician looking at this computer, seeing that directory, would know that those are operating system files and would have no way of knowing that, in fact, those are, in this case, legal photos, but in the offender's case, pornographic photos. So again, this computer would be presumably returned to the offender. The offender takes his computer back, enters in a single command, which again, I swear I'm not this bad of a typer. And once again, we go back to the directory, and boom, there's your photos, they're back. And this is an entry-level skill set. I know that as a network engineer, you might think that I'm enormously talented and only I have this, yeah, right. But this is basic command line knowledge that someone who has taken one or two computer classes will be able to run. So just a quick demonstration for members of the committee to see how this can be a real problem. Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for any questions.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Ellis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo and maybe even Mr. Debo can help us out. You know, in Minnesota law, if you use a car to commit prostitution, they can take your car. So on for drugs, so on for other things, DUIs, they take your car. So this seems sort of in line with what we've been doing. Are the same protections there? That's my question. For example, does an innocent third party, when they get the computer back, I mean, if you got one family member who's doing this, using the computer for porno, and somebody else who has nothing to do with it, can they get the computer back? Are the other protections in place that are there for other forfeiture cases?
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
My name is Hillary Caligiuri. I'm a prosecutor with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, yes, all of the normal protections in other forfeiture cases would be present with this law. This also provides an additional way for owners of data to get that specific data back. For instance, the wife who has something on the computer, to get that data back in addition to those protections that are already existing under the normal forfeiture laws.
Representative Ellis.
Same timelines, 60 days.
All the same as the normal 609.5311 to 5317 or whatever it is. Everything else is the same.
Any further questions? I don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, witnesses. We'll chair lays the bill over for possible inclusion. Representative Ellison, you're up. House File 1886, Property Crime Dollar Threshold Amount Study Committee established. Want to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will move House File 1886 for possible inclusion.
Very good. Go ahead.
First of all, Mr. Chair, I'd like to advise the committee members that this bill doesn't cost anything. Second of all, I'd like to pass out this statutory history and comparative analysis of Minnesota dollar threshold for theft.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do here, Mr. Chair and members, is recognize the fact that our theft statutes have a whole, are set up basically in terms of the amount of money that you steal varies with the severity of the offense. So if you steal a little, you have a misdemeanor, you steal a moderate amount, gross misdemeanor, you steal a lot, theft, and then the penalties go up from there. And you'll see that as you look through the materials that that there is a scale. And as the more they're stolen, the more severe the offense. But if you look at our Minnesota offenses, you'll see that we haven't had any adjustments in our theft statute since like 1987 for theft over $500. So in 1987, we made a policy decision that $500 worth of theft is what we want to call a felony. But as we know, there's probably been at least a inflation rate of about 3% since that time. So obviously today it's considerably more than that. All this bill does is say we're going to ask the Guidelines Commission and a few other agencies to get together and make some recommendations to us as to what a new scheme should be based on the passage of time and the increase in inflation. And if you look through the materials that I'm submitting, you'll see that several other states call a felony theft case $1,000 in some case, $2,500 in another state is the threshold amount. And I just think it bears study. And so that, you know, I think there's a lot of other benefits to it, including we're seeing felony cases of like $501 brought into our felony center, given that they're probably going to have a time that's pretty short anyway. So and I think that it's a common sense thing to do, and it doesn't cost us anything, and it'll probably help us save money and have better public policy in the long run. So with that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Ellison. Are there any questions? Any further testimony? Sounds good. We'll lay the bill over for possible inclusion. Then why don't we move right on then to House File 2032. Prostitution, Representative Ellison, prostitution crimes expanded to include loitering with intent to participate in prostitution, pilot projects to reduce homelessness, provided vagrancy crime repealed and money appropriated. Go ahead with the motion.
Mr. Chair, I will move House File 1877. I have a handout that I'm passing around. I also have a testifier we'll get to in a moment.
House File 2032.
Oh, thank you. 2032.
Good.
Yeah, my mistake. Thank you for correcting me there. Actually, this bill, the name of it is somewhat misleading because it suggests that there's an expansion of prostitution crimes, and in fact, there really is not. What's going on here, members, is that there is a vagrancy statute in Minnesota law. And the vagrancy statute makes it a crime if you are a person with the ability to work who is without lawful means of support and is not under 18 years of age. In other words, if you're homeless, I think you can read that way. A person found loitering in any near any structure, vehicle, or private grounds who is there without consent of the owner, it's a crime to commit trespass now, but again, you know, people who are homeless. Then you see paragraph 3, which if you're looking on the sheet that I'm handing out right in the middle, it does mention the prostitution. And the last one, a person who derives support in whole or in part from begging or as a fortune teller or a similar imposter. This bill would repeal this statute. However, it would include and replace it. It would basically retain paragraph 3. Why? Because neighbors and people who engage in prostitution do create a livability a problem for neighbors. Neighbors don't want people committing prostitution, walking around, doing what folks know that they're doing in the area of loitering to commit prostitution. So that is retained, and that's why the name, the bill is sort of labeled as it is. But essentially what we're trying to do here is to repeal a statute that essentially criminalizes homelessness. I would like to let you know that there are, cities can pass laws to prohibit begging. They can pass laws against public urination, and many cities do. I know my city of Minneapolis does. But what cities probably cannot do is criminalize a status of a person. And so I think that's what these bills, this vacancy statute essentially does. And as I said before, it retains the portion that probably does have a legitimate public safety and public livability purpose, which is paragraph 3 involving prostitution. Now, the other part of the bill is essentially establishes a homelessness outreach pilot project, which is a proven strategy in addressing homelessness in major U.S. cities. What it does is it sets up outreach workers who will go out to the homeless community and work with law enforcement and other government service providers to try to bring homeless people into a state where they can end our long-term homeless status. So with that, I'm going to ask, with the chair's indulgence, if Miss Rachel Callahan, right? can speak unless anybody has any questions for me.
Why don't you go right ahead, ma'am? Give us your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Callahan, and I'm a policy advocate with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. I thank you very much tonight for allowing me to testify in support of House File 2032. I think Representative Ellison gave a very good overview of what we are trying to accomplish here. I wanted to start out with just giving, because I know this committee probably doesn't hear a lot about homelessness, I wanted to give just a quick overview about homelessness in the state of Minnesota. And I'm going to, I know you hear a lot of numbers around here, I'm going to ask you to remember just four different numbers. And I'd also ask that you please try to keep in mind that behind every number there's a human being and a human story behind that number. So the first number I'll ask you to remember is 20,000. That's the number of homeless people and precariously housed people we have in the state of Minnesota on a given day. The second number is 4,000. That's the number of people who are considered long-term homeless. Those folks have been homeless for a year or longer. And the governor's plan to end long-term homelessness is targeted to help get those exact people into housing and the services they need. The third number I'll ask you to remember is 1,000. That's the number of people that we turn away from homeless shelters on a given night because we lack the resources to provide emergency shelter for those folks. The final number I'll ask you to remember is 117. That's the number of people who died in Minnesota during 2004 while they were homeless. So Minnesota does have a significant homeless problem. It is truly a statewide problem. 28% of people who are homeless are in outside of the 7-county Twin Cities metro area. So it truly is a statewide problem. I want to talk about the two main components of the bill that Representative Ellison outlined already. The first portion of the bill would create a pilot project for homeless outreach. That pilot project would help reduce recidivism. It will strengthen communities, and it will save our law enforcement, court system, jails, money. These folks are better served by being linked with the services and the housing that they need. The criminal justice system is not the appropriate response for people who have significant or serious mental illness, who have a chemical dependency issue, or who are simply homeless without a home. And that's what we hope to get at with this pilot project.
arrest and lockup are temporary and very expensive methods at getting at these issues. We have worked with communities, St. Paul, Minneapolis, Duluth, are all working very hard to coordinate with law enforcement, community leaders, and homeless service providers to get at the issue in a more lasting, productive way. And the resources that we're requesting here for this pilot project would assist in those efforts. The pilot project would take place in Hennepin County, Ramsey County, and one county to be determined in Greater Minnesota. I spoke with someone from Churches United in Ministry today from Moorhead, and he expressed to me that they have a great need for this kind of resource and this kind of street outreach to the homeless in Moorhead, and they would see this as a real help in their efforts in that city. The other portion I want to talk about is the state vagrancy statute. We have done some legal research on that. We do believe that the three portions of the statute that Representative Ellison pointed out, we do believe they are unconstitutional and are targeting individuals because of their status of being homeless. And so we're trying to work to ensure that people are not people experiencing homelessness are not equated with being criminals. Because many of them are just down on their luck and just really need the resources to get back on their feet. The bottom line is that the data supports a better approach to addressing homelessness. We have only had a chance to really analyze some of the arrest and other law enforcement report data in Minneapolis. But what we found was that in the two-year span of time for 2003 and 2004, there were 9,717 police reports filed. So some were arrests, some were booked, were just citations and released, some were transporting to detox. But of these 9,700 police reports, roughly estimate that if you averaged about 2 hours per report for police time, that's costing the city of Minneapolis about $583,000 in that two-year span of time. So it is expensive to address homelessness in this way, and that's just police time alone. That doesn't even count booking fees, jail time, the court fees, or court costs, that kind of thing. So we do believe that this kind of approach, with street outreach being the first step to getting these folks into the stability of housing and services that they need, will really move us in a much more positive direction in meeting the true needs of these folks. And with that, I will stand for any questions.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ellison, insofar as the vagrancy statute is concerned, I'm really with you on subparagraph one, which defines the one where an individual is not seeking employment. Now, that, to me, really would be the definition of a homeless person. I'm not so sure I agree with you on subdivision two. You've got somebody that's loitering outside my home, would not necessarily be a homeless person, and I'm not so sure I want to remove the ability of a police officer to tell that person to move along. So I'll just have to give that one a little thought.
May I respond, Mr. Chair?
You bet. Representative Ellis.
I think that's a fair observation, Representative Newman. I really do. And as I thought about it, we walked through this carefully and tried to think about it. And what I reflected upon is that if somebody was messing around outside your house and didn't have any good reason to be there without your consent, they could well be a trespasser. They could be a peeping Tom even. I think that there's a number of statutes that they could well be violating if they were to do that. So that's one of the reasons why I felt comfortable in repealing that. Now, that may not be a perfectly adequate answer for you, but that is the thinking that I had, because, Representative Newman, I got constituents too, and they don't, you know, and I got homeless problems in my district, with, and you probably have some too, and I don't want to create a situation where, you know, my neighbors are who the ones who tend to call are calling me up because I was behind making their neighborhood less livable, right? So I get you there, but I just think though that you know, you get some stat, you get there, it is against the law to look in somebody's window. It is against it, there's a statute prohibiting that. Trespass is against the law. There's stalking statutes, harassment orders you can obtain, and so there are a number of things. If you were to call an officer and say somebody's kind of lurking around my house, I think you could definitely deal with them. So those are some thoughts. I think Ms. Callahan has a thought on it too.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I may answer the question from Representative Newman.
Yes, Ms. Callahan, go ahead.
In some of the legal analysis that we've had done, there was a statute that was almost identical to that very provision in Wisconsin law, and that section was struck down as unconstitutionally vague. So I understand your concerns, and we certainly echo Representative Ellison's concerns, but the reality is, from the analysis that we've done, we do believe that that section would be unconstitutional if it were challenged.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison, before we went to the testifier, you used the word lurking.
Yeah.
I don't see that in the bill. I guess I'm not trying to be too facetious, but you used...
lurking.
Are you interchanging the two words, or what am I hearing?
Well, say that one more time.
I guess I'm asking, I heard you use the word lurking before we went to Ms. Callahan, but I don't see the word lurking in the bill. Are they interchangeable, or what am I hearing you say?
Yeah, let me be a little clearer, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that question. What I'm saying is that there are other, not contained in this bill, but there are other statutes which go to the behavior that Representative Newman is concerned about. He identified a scenario where somebody might be hanging around his house, lurking, that's how I used it, around his house. And my response was, there are probably three or four other statutes that officers could rely on to stop that behavior. And that's how I use the term lurking.
Anything else from anyone? Any questions? Representative Ellison?
I was just going to say, now, paragraph four, you know, the fortune teller thing, that's probably need to get rid of that. Okay. All right.
Paragraph four.
Thank you.
Very good. We'll lay the bill over. We have no further business before this committee this evening, therefore we are adjourned.
System. These people generally are going to be on probation. Most are going to go to workhouse, not go to prison. But if that person ends up with a dirty UA or not calling their PO or something like that, that person could end up in our prison system. Do we really want that? Given that they're probably going
to... ...that the committee added last year and really was an attempt to get at a lack of resources, for no better terminology. And...